Theater.
In the air.
Dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind.
You know what our call letters WGN stand for, don't you?
Welcome to WGN Radio Theater.
A special three-hour presentation.
And your hosts, Carl Amari and Lisa Wolf.
All right, it's 10 minutes after 10 p.m. here on the WGN Radio Theater, world's greatest newspaper, Lisa, the vivacious one herself right next to me. How you doing, Lisa?
Hi, Carl. Glad to be here. It's a big Saturday night.
It is. We have Shante Garth, our producer, in the booth. And we have five classic radio shows all the way to 3 o'clock in the morning.
And we have a full five-hour show tonight,
yeah.
So we're really excited about that.
Yep, we're going to start things off with You Bet Your Life. Our listeners have been clamoring for more Groucho Marx. So we have a Groucho Marx episode for you from 1955. After that, a true crime case on Whitehall, 1212 from 1952. Then we have The Lives of Harry Lime. Orson Welles stars as Harry Lime from 1951. Then Robert Young stars as Jim Anderson, Father Knows Best from 1950. And then we'll wrap things up with a Gunsmoke episode from 1956 starring William Conrad.
Right. And before that, we usually have our little segment, which used to be Guess That Song. We've decided to move on from Guess That Song.
We're retiring it. Should we have taps? Should we play taps for it?
Yeah, that's okay. That's okay. Because we're on to bigger and better here. I guess you're going to do what you want. Our new segment.
Once I get going, it's hard to stop.
Our new segment is called Just the Facts.
Yeah.
You'll learn a little bit more about it. It's going to be some fun facts, trivia, and history from the year of the radio show that we will be playing in that hour.
Okay.
So we can look forward to a little background.
And we haven't rehearsed this. I don't know what she's going to be talking about.
Not
We're
a
just going to have some fun with it. And all that begins right after these words.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you're about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
This is our new Just the Facts segment. I hope you all recognize that theme song.
Yeah, I've heard it once or
Carl,
twice.
Once or twice, pretty much here on this radio show from Dragnet. And we are going to be talking about 1955, which is the radio show we'll be playing in Hour 1, You Bet Your Life. So first of all, the best, happiest, most magical place on earth opened July 17th, 1955.
Disneyland. What? Has
Disneyland.
To be Disneyland.
It is Disneyland. Let's hear that.
Disneyland is dedicated to the ideals, the dreams.
This is Walt Disney speaking.
That have created America with the hope that it will be a source of joy and inspiration to all the world.
I can tell you that Mike Costello did not digitally remaster that clip.
Absolutely not. But this was actually recorded in 1955 by Walt Disney himself.
Wow.
And what do you think he did to pave the way for more magic?
The guy was a genius.
He sure was.
And his head is frozen, I think, right now.
that's probably.
Cryogenically frozen.
I think that's true. Also, now in 1955, we had the first large home microwave oven. That's when actually they started going into people's homes. It was invented in 45. That's when the patent was actually filed. But Tappan introduced a large 220-volt home. They were all Tappan. And that's what we did. You have a microwave oven growing up?
I think as a kid we had a microwave oven. I think
you don't remember.
Well, I mean, not when I was real young. So probably around. I would guess we got our first microwave oven
probably in the 60s.
Like, I was going to say late 60s.
I kind of remember getting them when we got it. It was sort of a big deal to have it.
Oh, yeah.
And at this point, who doesn't have a microwave?
Everyone has a microwave.
Well, I don't know about that.
I mean, pretty much every household.
I think so, but maybe we would be surprised.
Yeah.
And other than that, Rosa Parks, this was 1955, refused to give up her bus seat. This was in Montgomery, Alabama, December 1st of 55.
Wow.
And of course, this event was a catalyst for the civil rights movement in the United States.
Wow. Okay. Great stuff.
Some
1955.
Great facts.
It was the same year that You Bet Your Life was right. broadcast, and we have a You Bet Your Life episode for you right now. But first, I want to remind all of our listeners about our website that has 5 free classic radio shows waiting for you. Now, when you go to 100radioshows.com, so 100radioshows.com, you go to the top of the website, you just put your email in, and you will be sent 5 classic radio shows digitally remastered as a thank you for listening to this show. You'll get Suspense with Gregory Peck, Jack Benny, you'll get Richard Diamond, Private Detective, Gunsmoke, and Fibber McGee and Molly. 5 shows, full-length shows, digitally remastered by Mike, sent to you instantly. As soon as you put your email in and hit send, you'll get it within like a minute. I was with Dave Plyer the other day, and he did it, and he had them like instantly.
He did it while you were talking
Yeah,
with
we were
him?
Talking, and yeah. we had dinner, and he did it, and boom, he had it.
Boom, right to your email.
He was like, wow, I already have
magic.
Now, at that same website, there are 7 collections that have 100 radio shows in each one of those collections. And if you use the promo code radio at checkout, you will save 70% off the regular price. So our listeners get not only 5 free shows, but they save 70% on anything they want to buy. But make sure you use the promo code radio at checkout. All right, You Bet Your Life was a game show hosted by the great Groucho Marx of the Marx Brothers fame. And the assistant and announcer on the show was George Fenneman. It began on ABC Radio way back in 1947. It made a transition to television in 1950, but for many years it overlapped. It was on radio and TV. Each show offered a secret word like house, money, hat, etc., and contestants would banter about their life with Groucho, and if by chance they said the secret word, well, they'd get $100. Not bad.
I love right? the concept.
Get $100. And then they'd also win money for answering questions put to them by Groucho at the end of the show, and oftentimes there were celebrity contestants, too. You Bet Your Life enjoyed a long run, bowing out in 1961, so from 47 to 61. You Bet Your Life. So the secret word on this particular episode is clock. Groucho Marx, George Fenneman, January 31st, 1955. Uninterrupted, here is You Bet Your Life.
Ladies and gentlemen, the secret word tonight is clock. C-L-O-C-K.
Really?
You Bet Your Life. The more than 3,000 DeSoto Plymouth dealers of America present Groucho Marx in You'll Bet Your Life, the comedy quiz series produced and transcribed from Hollywood. And here he is, the one, the only...
Groucho! That's me, Groucho Marx. Well, here I am again with $1,000 for one of our couples. Fenneman, who's first to try for it?
Well, Groucho, just before we went on the air, our studio audience selected a clerk from the unemployment office, Mrs. Louise Ludwig, and her partner, Mrs. Marjorie Kendall, was selected because of her unusual occupation. And here they are. Ladies, come right up here and meet Groucho Marx.
Well, welcome, kids, for the DeSoto Plymouth dealers. And if you say the secret word and divide $100, it's a common word, something you see every day. Mrs. Louise Ludwig? That's you. Where are you from, Louise?
I'm from Honolulu.
From Honolulu?
Yes.
Oh. How long have you been away from Honolulu?
It's been many years since I was 12 years old.
It's been many years since you were 12 years old? Oh, I don't think so.
Shall I tell you how many years, though?
Well, I don't want to pry into your private life, Mrs. Ludwig. You're a very attractive young girl. I'll keep my mouth shut. And you're married, huh?
Yes, Mr. Marx.
What does your husband do?
He's a driver's license examiner for the motor vehicle department.
Oh. Well, I'll be mighty nice to you. Marjorie Kendall, you were chosen because of your unusual occupation. Now, what sort of work do you do?
I'm a secretary and part-time genealogist.
Oh, I see. Well, what is a genealogist?
One who trace family lineages, family trees.
Now, Margie, how did you become interested in family trees? Were you looking for termites or...
No, I was looking at my own family history.
Uh-huh. I started looking at my family once, but I stopped when I got the chick. I was frightening. Now, how far did you trace your family?
To 445 A.D.
I'd be satisfied if you could trace me back to 445 A.M. Although I'm not sure I want to go back there again. Now, Marjorie, why should people want to know their family trees? Isn't that a little snobbish?
Oh, no. It's a curiosity on the part of almost everyone to know what their family name means.
How about the name Marks? Could you look up the family tree?
Oh, I did several years ago with several other Hollywood personalities.
Is that so? Why should you look up my name?
Well, because it was you were an interesting person, and I've always admired you and was my favorite comedian.
I've never did anything that any other boy couldn't do. Now, what did you find in my family tree?
Oh, mostly, of course, you have a beautiful crest.
Say, you look pretty good yourself. What do you mean by a beautiful crest?
In the crest.
You mean a family crest?
Yes, sir.
Like two horse thieves swinging from a potted palm?
Two wings that were partly crossed and a little bit of gold embellished on them. And
you mean I had wings? Was the crest of the Marks family?
Yes, sir.
You mean my forefathers were fan dancers, eh? Now, Mrs., you're with the unemployment office?
Yes, Mr. Murray.
Uh-huh. Where is that?
I work in the harbor area.
In the water? And what are your duties there?
Well, I attempt to find positions for people who are in need of them.
Could you find a position for me?
Well, very possibly. What kind of work are you interested in?
Why should I be interested in work with the racket I've got? Now, suppose I'm unemployed. You can never tell about sponsors, you know. Of course, the DeSoto Plymouth are different, eh? In a DeSoto, you drive without shifting. You ought to be very happy with me. I'm about as shiftless as they come. Where was I? Oh, yes. What kind of jobs do you have the most calls for?
Well, highly skilled technicians and, of course, good secretaries are always hard to get.
Yes, they are, especially for a man of my age. Even fair ones I'm having difficulty with. Now, how is the unemployment situation out your way right now?
As I say, that demand for highly skilled remains prevalent, but the mackerel season is
The mackerel season is on now?
Yes.
Well, how many unemployed mackerel are there? That's as fishy a story as I ever heard. Okay, now let's see if you'll get the chance at the $1,000. Fenneman, explain the rules.
Well, you bet as much of your $20 as you want on each of four questions. And the couple that earns the most money gets a chance at the $1,000 DeSoto Plymouth question at the end of the show.
Okay, here we go. Let's see how high I can build you $20. You've selected personalities of the 20s. Here's your first question. How much will you bet?
$10.
$10, okay. The Bambino was undisputed king of the ballparks during the 20s. What was his name?
Babe Ruth.
Babe Ruth is right.
And you're on your way. You have $30.
Remember, you're going for $1,000 tonight. Now, how much of the $30 will you bet on your second question?
29,
huh? Okay. Who defeated Jack Dempsey twice, the second time in 1927? He was an ex-Marine.
Gene Tunney.
Gene Tunney is correct.
You're reclimbing now. You have $59.
You're climbing with $59. Here's your third question. How much are you going to go for? 55. Okay. The Hopalong of the 20s was a straight-shooting cowboy with a horse named Tony. What was the cowboy's name?
Tom Mix.
Tom Mix is correct.
$114.
$114, and here's your last chance to be the other couples. How much of the
$114?
Oh. All of it? Okay, you're gamblers. What was the name of the colorful revivalist who during the 20s drew thousands of people to his meetings?
Billy Sunday.
Billy Sunday is correct.
And you wind up with $228.
Thank you very much.
Fenneman, just a moment. There's something I want to clear up. Remember last week in the quiz, one question was, what do you call the Australian and New Zealand troops of both world wars? You remember that?
I remember the question.
Well, the Austrian war bride and her husband, she said diggers, and I said that was wrong because the official name was Anzacs. Well, a lot of people said Diggers was the slang name for him, so we're sending Mr. and Mrs. Schwander $180. Fortunately, it wasn't enough to affect the standings for the big question, so thank heaven that remains the same as it turned out on the show. All right, on with it, Fenneman. Who's next?
We invited some women from the Federation of State Societies to the program tonight, and we selected Mrs. Florence Parsons. Her partner is a husband from the studio audience, Mr. Bob Smith. Folks, come on in here and meet Groucho Marx.
Welcome, folks, to You Bet Your Life. You say the secret word, and you win $100 between you. It's a common word, something you see every day. Mrs. Florence Parsons, eh? You're from the Federation of State Societies?
Yes, I am.
What is that? Is that the Confederate Army?
It's an organization of the people from the different states as they've come into California.
I see. Oh, I see. Where are you from?
I'm from Williamsburg, Massachusetts.
Williamsburg? Yes. What part of California is that in?
That's not in California. It is in Massachusetts.
Williamsburg, isn't that where Cal Coolidge came from?
No, he really was born in Vermont, but he lived in Northampton, just a few miles from Williamsburg, 10 miles.
Did you know Cal Coolidge?
Slightly. They said that I had a longer conversation with him than did any congressman that ever cooled his heels in the White House.
And a congressman can cool plenty of heels, too. Do you remember that conversation at all, Mrs.
Yes,
Parsons?
Yes, I do.
Could you give us a little of it?
Well, I was visiting a neighbor of Coolidge, and their farms adjoined. And I was sitting in the garden, looking over the hedge, when Coolidge was seen approaching, and I wanted to escape, but my friend...
Why, are you a Democrat?
No, I wasn't, but I was afraid to meet him. So he came through the hedge, and when I was introduced, he said, "Oh, from Los Angeles, a beautiful town. I have spoken there. I hope you'll have a pleasant visit and a safe journey home."
Well, that was very nice.
That was about the extent of our conversation.
Well, that was quite a conversation. I don't think Mrs. Coolidge ever got that much out of him. Your name is Bob Smith?
That's correct.
What sort of work do you do, Bob?
I work for a sewing machine company.
A sewing machine? You don't look like you did any sewing.
No, I'm a motor man on a sewing machine.
You're a motor man on a sewing machine? Where do you drive it, up Hollywood Boulevard? I suppose old Bobbin pulls it, huh? Well, Bobbin is on a sewing machine. I happen to know because I'm an old so-and-so myself. Now, Bob, where is your home?
I was born in Seattle, Washington, but I left there when I was 2 years old.
Oh. You left there when you were two? Wanderlust, eh? That's pretty early to leave home, isn't it? Where did you go?
To Alaska.
So Alaska is your home, eh?
No, I went from there to Portland, Oregon.
Is Portland your hometown?
No, from Portland I went to Niagara Falls.
Oh, that's your hometown, eh?
No, went to Washington, D.C.
For a two-year-old, you said you got around. Well, I can keep this up as long as you can. Where did you go after that?
Washington, D.C. I went to Dallas, Texas.
The sheriff never got tired, huh? Well, I give up. Let's leave you right where you are, and don't move until I come back to you, will you? I'm liable to be in Tampa by the time I get there. Mrs. Parsons, how old are you?
Old? Why, we never talk of age in the Federation. We are ageless.
I'm sorry, Mrs. Parsons. How young are you?
Well, the gypsies tried to steal me when I was 5 years old.
I may steal you tonight, Mrs. Parsons.
This man is a gypsy.
This man is a gypsy?
Yes, sir.
You're a gypsy? You don't look like a gypsy. I thought all gypsies wore bandanas, and played the accordion and wore gold earrings. Why, you look just like me. Why is that?
A lot of gypsies do.
Anybody care to have his palm read? Are you married, Bob?
Yes, I am.
How did you meet your wife?
My father introduced her to me.
Well, that was a very friendly gesture on your part. Why was your father so interested in this girl?
Well, he gave $1,500 for her and selected her for to be my wife.
It's a lot of money for one girl. How come your father paid $1,500 for your wife?
Well, that's a custom among the English gypsies and among all the gypsies.
Always pay $1,500?
No, not necessarily
$1,500. Can you get one for $6.98 or something like that?
Hardly.
How much did your wife weigh at this time?
About 70 pounds.
$1,500 and 70 pounds. Let's see. That comes to about $22 a pound. That's a pretty stiff price to pay for a wife. You can buy caviar for $22 a pound. Of course, it's pretty lonely in the evening sitting there with a dish of caviar. You think your father made a shrewd investment, Bob?
I think so, because a very short time after he was married, my wife made enough telling fortunes to pay my father back.
Oh. She should have read her own fortune first, and she'd be $1,500 ahead. And has this marriage turned out successfully? Have you been happy, Bob?
Yes, very successfully. I got about the best girl in the world.
Well, you ought to know. You've been all over the world. Now, Mrs. Parsons, tell us something about your work. What sort of work do you do?
Well, my work is very complicated. It consists of so many details. We have picnics for every state in the Union. They have...
I used to entertain at picnics. I was known as a picnic ham.
In a sandwich?
Yes, in a sandwich. I was boiled a good deal of the time. Well, what is the largest of these picnics?
Iowa is by far the largest.
We often have 130,000 at the Iowa picnic.
And imagine, 130,000 people at a picnic.
Oh, we
have... To me, it's no picnic if there's more than two people, Mrs. Parker. And sometimes even then it's no picnic. How much does your husband pay for you, Mrs. Parsons?
Nothing at all.
He got you for nothing? Well, yes. He stole you.
That is as you think.
Well, I certainly do. I think you were a big bargain. Have you been a good wife, Mrs. Parsons?
I think I have. Oh. Fairly good.
Oh, you're qualifying it now.
Yes.
Huh? All the time you've been married, you've been good for nothing, eh? That's an old joke, but I've chased this gypsy so much tonight, I'm getting weary, eh? Well, this has been an interesting conversation. And if I ever want my palm red, I'll stick it in the bucket of red paint. Now then, let's see how well you make out in the race with $1,000. Now, you've got to run your $20 into more than our other couples. I can't tell you how much our first couple won, but Fenneman's off stage to remind our listeners.
The unemployment clerk and the genealogist won $228.
Now, here we go. You have $20. You selected scrambled proverbs. How much are you going to bet on your first question?
$10.
You can bet anything you want. $10? Is that all right with you, Florence?
Yes.
I'll call you Florence. Huh?
Certainly.
Now, here's your first question. You're betting $10. What is this proverb? Adult and his legal tender are quickly disassociated.
Man and his money are soon parted. A fool and his money are soon
parted.
That's
right. A fool and his money are soon parted.
$30.
Remember, you're going for $1,000 tonight. Now, how much of the 30 are you going to risk?
25.
A rotating boulder will not amass a form of lichen.
A rolling stone will gather no moss.
A rolling stone gathers no moss.
You're going to roll up to $55.
Florence, you're a pretty sharp cookie. Now, how much are you going to bet on your third question?
50.
50?
Yes, 50.
Here we go. It is inadvisable to enumerate fowls in your possession prior to the moment of their nativity.
Do not count your chickens
before they hatch. Is absolutely right.
Now you two have climbed to $105.
Florence, have you been a chicken thief in your earlier days?
No, I never was.
Oh, well, I... A goose thief or a duck thief or any kind of fowl?
No, nothing of that kind.
Oh, that's a foul question. Here's your last chance to beat the other guy. What is this proverb? How much are they betting?
They haven't bet all of it. Is that right?
You want to bet all of it?
I don't.
Okay. A dual cranium is more acceptable than a single.
Two heads are better than one.
Clarence, put it there.
are because you wind up with $210.
Well, that's wonderful.
Congratulations. Thank you very much.
Congratulations to you both. That's quite a gal.
Sure is. Well, Groucho, the secret...
We all have a tendency to emphasize youth too much, and you see a gal like that, and it's really wonderful.
The secret word, you know, is still clock.
I know, I understand that.
Well, we invited some...
My memory isn't faltering yet,
I didn't mean that.
Even though yours is. No innuendos from you.
We invited some Hawaiian dancing girls to the program tonight.
Now you're talking.
Just before we went on the air, our studio audience selected Heilani Kawela.
Never mind this nonsense. Bring her in here, will you?
And her partner is a fencing master, Monsieur Jean Aromas. And here they are, folks. Come over here to meet Groucho Marx.
Well, welcome, welcome, welcome for the DeSoto Plymouth dealers, eh? Say the secret word and divide $100. It's a common word, something you see every day. A fencing master and a hula dancer, eh? Well, this may be interesting. He may cut off her grass skirt. Heilani Kawela, is that right?
Heilani
Kawela. Heilani Kawela. Well, where are you from, Heilani?
The islands.
The islands, eh? The islands. Which islands? Coney, Catalina, or a thousand?
I'm from Hawaii.
Hawaii? Is that the correct pronunciation? I thought it was Hawaii.
No, that's not right. Hawaii is correct.
Oh, you couldn't say Hawaii just once, eh? Please?
That's not correct.
What isn't correct?
Hawaii.
I'm all right. How are you? Tell her, Mom, it was a great fight, but I won. And Mr. Harriman's, eh? If you think I'm going to watch you tonight, you're crazy. You're a fencing master, huh? Where are you from?
Brussels, Belgium.
Oh, from Belgium, huh? You were raised in Belgium? You're sort of a Brussels sprout, then, in other words. But are you married?
Yes, sir.
Some fencer. He's got a sword hanging over his own head. Are you married?
No, I'm not.
Oh, thank the Lord. And praise the grass skirts, huh? I guess it'd be pretty hard for a hula dancer to nod her head yes when the rest of her is saying no. Where do you do your hula dancing?
Well, I work mostly casuals, one-night stands.
Where do you do your work, Jean?
At the Los Angeles Athletic Club and the University of Southern California.
Oh, well, that's a good place for a fence. Exactly what do you do there? Do you pick it?
No, I teach fencing because fencing is a very... popular sport now. It's very becoming.
Is that so? It's increasing in popularity?
Very,
but what
very
is
much.
There about fencing that makes it so popular?
Well, for women, for instance, grace, poise, elegance. For men, fast reaction. Then also the spirit of sportsmanship.
You mean puncturing somebody is a sportsmanship?
Well, in some way, yes.
You carry bicycle tape in your back pocket or something? Suppose I wanted to take up fencing. What would I need?
First of all, a mask, a jacket.
What do you think I'm wearing now?
I was saying a mask, a jacket, trousers, and tennis shoes, if possible.
Tennis shoes? What's that, for running?
No, you want slide when you make your lunch.
I make my lunch? Don't I carry my lunch with me? Well, wouldn't it be nice if I had a sword, too?
We don't use sword anymore.
You don't use a sword in fencing? What do you use, a mixmaster?
No, we use...
What do you mean, those swords?
We use foil, épée, and saber.
Épée? Isn't he one of the seven dwarfs?
No, it's a blade.
Well, épée was a blade, I remember. Well, let's talk about the hula. For example, just what is the hula? Besides a good way to keep warm on a cold night.
Tells a story by dancing.
Uh-huh. And all this time, I've been wasting my time reading books. What kind of stories does it tell? Mysteries?
There's no mystery about the hula.
Well, doesn't that depend on whether the grass and the skirt needs cutting? What kind of stories can you tell by dancing?
Oh, you tell love stories, and stories about the trees, the sun, the moon. They're all very simple stories.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does dancing tell a story? I don't understand.
Well, it tells a story by using the hands and the arms.
Mm-hmm.
Each
gesture you make has some significance, I suppose?
Yes, that's right.
And I bet you've told many a story and then tried to wiggle out of it, huh? Well, you've been a very interesting couple, particularly you, Heilani. And if I ever do any fencing, you can be sure it won't be with a hula dancer. Now you're going to play your bet your life. You run your $20 into more than the other couples, and you'll get a chance at the $1,000 question. I can't tell you how much the other couples won, but Fenneman's going to remind our listeners.
The unemployment clerk and the genealogist are still leading with $228.
Here we go. Let's see how high I can build you $20. You selected modern composers. Here's your first question. How much will you bet?
$10.
$10? Okay. Who composed Begin the Begin?
Cole Porter.
Cole Porter is right.
$30.
Remember, you're going for $1,000. How much of the 30 you going to try?
20.
20? Who composed Summertime?
Gershwin.
Gershwin is right.
And you climbed with $50.
Now you got $50. Here's your third question. How much of the 50?
40.
40, you going to bet? All right. Who composed I've Told Every Little Star? Take a guess. Talk it over. And if you don't know, guess. Well, the bell is told. It was Jerome Kern. You should have known that. It's a very, very popular and very well-known song.
You now have $10.
Well, that's a shame. Now, it's your last chance to beat the other couples. How much of the 10 will you bet?
Ten.
Cute the works? Okay. Who composed White Christmas?
Irving Berlin.
Irving Berlin is right.
Grand total of $20, and that means the unemployment clerk and the genealogist with $228 get the chance at the DeSoto Plymouth $1,000 question. Here comes the winning couple, Groucho, the unemployment clerk and the genealogist, all set for the $1,000 DeSoto Plymouth question.
All right, here we go for $1,000. I'll give you 15 seconds to decide on a single answer between you, so think carefully and please no help from the audience. Here it is. One of our presidents served only 30 days, the shortest service in presidential history. For $1,000, tell me, who was this president? All right, what is the answer you two have decided upon?
Yes, we're wrong, but we thought Buchanan.
No, I'm sorry. It was William Henry Harrison. That was a tough question. But anyway, you won. How much did they win?
$228.
You won $220, so that means the big question next week will be worth $1,500. Well, you lost the big money, but you won $220 in the quiz. Congratulations and thanks to both of you and to all of our contestants on the show tonight.
Be sure to tune in again next Wednesday night at this time for the Groucho Marx Show, when the big question will be worth $1,500. And don't miss Groucho's television show, also presented by the DeSoto Plymouth Dealers of America. And remember, all dealers who sell DeSoto also sell Plymouth. Two great cars, both products of the Chrysler Corporation.
By the way, folks, if you have nothing better to do, you might curl up with the February issue of Coronet Magazine and read the piece about me by my brother Harpo. Doesn't make any sense, but I think you'll enjoy it. The February Coronet Magazine. Good night, folks, and remember, now just be sure to visit your DeSoto Plymouth dealer.
Folks, here's a reminder from the National Safety Council. Keep your car in safe operating condition. You Bet Your Life, transcribed from Hollywood, is produced by John Goodell. Directed by Robert Dwan and Bernie Smith. Music by Jerry Fielding. This is George Fenneman signing off for the more than 3,000 DeSoto Plymouth dealers from coast to coast.
You bet your life, Lisa. You bet your life.
I'd rather bet yours.
No, I don't want to bet my life. You bet your life.
No, I'll bet yours.
January 31st, 1955, the secret word clock. It was sponsored by DeSoto Plymouth. It was funny because he talked a little bit about how you used to have to shift the cars back then. You know, and this was the first year that it was shiftless. So it was an automatic transmission.
I think you have to say that word really carefully or it sounds like something else.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. speaking of Coligard, we were talking about Coligard earlier.
We were?
Yeah. Remember we were talking about
you mean in the car?
Job. Yeah. Coligard.
Yep.
I think it's better than a colonoscopy.
I did Coligard.
Yeah. Did
it's
you like it?
It's better than a what?
Was
did
it
you
good?
Call it? What did you call it?
Colonoscopy. What is it? What is it?
If you think about it, maybe it's harder.
Colonoscopy. Okay.
Right. I did Coligard. My doctor told me
I just got one in the mail.
I'll give you instructions.
This is not for radio consumption.
No, it's not. Let's move on.
Yeah, it's not. But anyway, that was You Bet Your Life. You know, the reason why it sounded so tight and so great and like the jokes were right on and he was super fast and everything is because they used to tape. This used to go 40, 50, 60 minutes in front of a studio audience. And they would, you know, talk with the people and then editing. They would edit it down later and then it was broadcast. So it was basically broadcast live on tape, they called that. And then the same thing, they would, you know, film it as well. Again, the whole 40, 50, 60 minutes. And then edit that down as well. And what you watched on television, which I watch all the time on Antenna TV, they have You Bet Your Life. And when you watch it, it's so fast and quick, and he's right on the money.
And he's very quick.
He is.
As well.
He is great.
Very
but you, you know, but it, but there's a lot that can be done in editing. Hope you enjoyed You Bet Your Life. Let's take a quick break. Then it's more on the WGN Radio Theater. All right, Lisa. In our next hour, we have Whitehall 1212. Which was a true crime series with an all-British cast. It was produced here in the States by Willis Cooper, who created Lights Out. Really good series. I think you're going to like it. And that is coming up in just a few minutes. So stay with us, folks, right here on WGN. We will be here until 3 o'clock in the morning with Classic Radio. Stay tuned. All right, hour two of the WGN Radio Theater. I'm your host, Carl Amari. To my right, the vivacious one herself, Lisa Wolf. And in this hour, Whitehall 1212 from 1952. A little later, we'll have Orson Welles and the Lives of Harry Lime. Really interesting because there was a movie, as you know, called The Third Man. And that starred Orson Welles as Harry Lime and Joseph Cotton in that movie. It was so popular that radio producer Harry Allen Towers said to Orson Welles, let's do a radio show about The Third Man. And he's like, well, how can we do that? I died in the movie. I mean, my character, Harry Lime, you can't. And he said, no, we'll do it. We'll do a prequel. Well, the whole radio series will be about your character, Harry Lime. He's like, well, we can't call it The Third Man. I die in that movie. He's like, well, we'll call it The Lives of Harry Lime. Based on, you know, the character from The Third Man. And it was very popular. And we have an episode in our next hour on that. And then Robert Young in Father Knows Best, primarily remembered as a television show, but there was a long-running radio show. And then Gunsmoke, William Conrad as U.S. Marshal Matt Dillon. In fact, pretty much all of these shows except for Orson Welles, Lives of Harry Lime, and Whitehall 1212. Every other show, You Bet Your Life, Father Knows Best, and Gunsmoke, all air on Antenna TV. Yeah. Mm. So you can watch them, you know, and we're playing the radio shows, and then you watch the TV counterparts on Antenna TV. We're also going to play our game, Just the Facts, brought to you by Cat's Pride. And that's in our next hour, so stay... Oh, no. What,
that's in
hour.
This hour.
This hour, right. We're going to just go to a quick commercial break,
we'll
and then we're
right
going to play our game and also play Whitehall 1212.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you're about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
This is our new segment, Just the Facts, fun facts, trivia, and history. This hour will be from 1952, which is the year that we are going to be playing for Whitehall 1212.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is all brought to you by Cat's Pride.
Of course it is. So, okay, this is one of my favorite things. I Love Lucy.
Yes.
Included the most popular and remembered skit from the show.
Oh, this has
what
to be
is it?
The chocolate, and it's on the conveyor belt.
That is a good one, but
that's
not
the
this
number one.
One.
That's well, a, okay, then that then she's crushing tomatoes or something like that, or cherries or something.
No, it's not. It's not
she's
that
stamp,
one.
Stomping. Grapes.
Grapes.
Stomping grapes.
No, it's not that one. But again, one of the most popular and remembered.
Well,
skits
I just
the
named
show.
The two most popular.
Well, then you forgot about this one.
Not no. The most popular. She's eating the candies.
Okay, let's hear it.
Hello, friends. I'm your Vitamita Benjamin girl.
Vitamita Benjamin.
Vitamita Benjamin.
Do you poop out at parties?
You poop out at parties.
The answer to all your problems is in this little bottle.
Now you pick up the bottle.
Oh.
A little higher. That's right.
The answer to all your problems is in this little bottle. Vitamita Benjamin. Vitamita Benjamin contains vitamins, meat, vegetables,
meat.
And minerals. Yes, with Vitamita Benjamin, you can spoon your way to health. All you do is take a tablespoonful after every meal.
Now you take some.
Oh.
Anyway, I remember, yeah.
All right,
I remember
this is a fantastic skit.
It was definitely.
All right, it's way up, way up there.
And she was like, because there was alcohol in it or something, she started getting
yep.
like a little
she was
punchy.
A little, she was punchy.
I
so,
remember that.
Great, great episode. That was 1952. Also, the most popular Christmas gifts from 1952 were, now this is going to bring
you
back some memories.
You never get me any Christmas gifts.
Yes, I always give you a Christmas gift.
Do you?
What did I give you this year?
Oh, you got me socks.
Well, no, it sounds funny when you say that, but be more specific.
Yeah, you got me. She got me socks that are with that have my initials on them.
There you go.
Pretty. That was pretty
personalized
nice.
Personalized socks. Anyways, the most popular Christmas gifts from 1952. Some of them were Mr. Potato Head,
right?
Which was the first toy advertised on American television.
Wow.
The Slinky Dog.
Oh, the dog?
The Slinky Dog.
I didn't like the Slinky Dog.
Why?
I liked the Slinky.
Why?
But not the Slinky Dog.
What's the matter with the dog?
I'll guarantee you the Slinky Dog did not sell as well as the Slinky itself.
Well, and a Pez candy dispensers,
oh,
which
had Pez.
Of course are still sold
Man,
today.
1952 Pez was around?
1952.
I love Pez when
Well,
I, was a
I don't
kid.
Think I really like the candy as much as the dispenser. Now,
I
that
had,
was the fun of
I had
it.
A Batman Pez.
Of course you did. And the board game. Scrabble became very popular in 1952.
Wow, okay.
They started selling it at Macy. William H. Macy made it popular,
wow.
as a matter of fact.
Wow.
So,
right.
great game.
Good stuff.
Great stuff.
Who was the president in 1952? I can't even, right now, I'm not good at that.
I could look it up the same way you could. But
maybe Eisenhower or something like that?
No.
I don't know. I'm trying to
I
think.
I don't know.
1952.
Do you want me to start letting you know that?
Yeah, I would like to know who the president was in
I
those
will
years.
Add that to our fun facts.
Right. I mean, for what I'm paying you, you should at least put that on there too, right?
We will have the president and fun facts next week. It was Harry S. Truman.
It was Truman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Truman.
Now you know.
All right.
Okay.
He beat Dewey. I know that.
All right.
All right. So in this hour, Whitehall, Whitehall, 1212. I said it twice. It
Whitehall,
said Whitehall,
Whitehall, 1212, 1212.
Our text in line, 312-981-7200. We love hearing from you folks. So give us a text so we can keep in touch with you. All right. Whitehall, 1212. It was a very interesting crime series. Came to NBC Radio in 1951 for two seasons. These were true crime cases from the files of Scotland Yard's Black Museum. And they were dramatized with an all-British cast. So if you were British and living in America, you might get cast in this at that
chance.
Time. It was like, he's like Willis Cooper who created it. We got to get some British actors in this. Find some British actors. He'd call the casting agent. And cast British people. That's what I did with the Twilight Zone. Whenever we'd have a Twilight Zone that was set in Britain, I would call Claire Simon.
It may as well be authentic.
The casting queen of Chicago.
Right.
I'd call her up. I'd say, Claire, I cast everyone you have that's British. that's what they did here. Willis Cooper created this series. He also created Lights Out and Quiet Please. And Whitehall 1212 was the then famous telephone number of Scotland Yard. It was there, you know, they would dial Whitehall 1212, almost like 911 now, you know. It was the headquarters of the London Metro. The series was hosted by Chief Superintendent John Davidson. He was the curator of the Block Museum.
Yeah.
Maybe I could do a part in this
show.
Yeah,
you would be great at pretending to have a British accent.
I would say, yes, Lisa.
As an old man.
Yeah, Lisa. Yeah.
This is called The Case of Maggie Rowlandson from May 25th, 1952. Uninterrupted, here is Whitehall 1212.
Whitehall 1212.
This is Scotland Yard.
For the first time in history, Scotland Yard opens its official files to bring you the true stories of some of its most baffling cases.
These are the true stories, the plain, unvarnished facts, just as they occurred, reenacted for you by an all-British cast. Only the names of the participants have, for obvious reasons, been changed. The broadcasts are presented with the full cooperation of Scotland Yard.
Research on Whitehall 1212 is furnished by Percy Hoskins of the London Daily Express. The stories for radio are written and directed by Willis Cooper. The voice you will now hear is that of Chief Superintendent John Davidson, custodian of Scotland Yard's famous Black Museum.
Good afternoon. Police officials from every part of the civilized world come to see us here at New Scotland Yard. Many of them are old friends of ours, of course. There are few enough police forces with whom Scotland Yard has not been in contact. The Surety of France, the American FBI, Canada's famous RCMP. We're all enlisted in the war against crime. And as the Bible says, state chapter of Ecclesiastes, third verse, there is no discharge in that war. We have an interesting visitor with us today. He came to glance at the exhibits here in case number 202131. Here, a doctor's instrument case and a pair of child's rompers. These, with certain other objects which were later given Christian burial, were important objects in that case. And our visitor is the man who had so much to do with solving the case, Captain Lionel Watt, the former Chief Constable of Lancaster.
I must tell you at once that this was a matter for the Lancaster Constabulary and the police of Dumfriesshire and Scotland. Purely, let us say, a local matter.
No, Scotland Yard was not engaged in this case at all. Captain Watt and his people solved this most baffling case themselves.
Yes, so far as I'm able to discover, we have only one procedure that's precisely like Scotland Yard's, John.
And that is?
We patronize the same hangman. Two miles north of the town of Moffat, which is in Dumfriesshire in Scotland, the main road from Carlisle to Edinburgh crosses the ravine where a small stream, Garden Holm Lynn, runs to the River Annan through a remarkably peaceful countryside. On the morning of the 29th of September, some years ago, several crudely wrapped bundles were observed lying on the banks of the ravine below the road. From one of the bundles protruded a naked human arm. The Dumfriesshire Constabulary naturally investigated. What they found added up to confusion as well as to horror. I was in the Moffat police station when their Sergeant Barnes made his first report.
Four bundles, one wrapped in the Daily Herald, the London Labourite newspaper, for 5th August this year. The second wrapped in a pillow slip, the third in a portion of cotton sheeting, and the fourth in another piece of sheeting, tied up with what appears to be the hem torn from the sheet. All the bundles contained pieces of people, to which straw was adhering, and a large quantity of cotton wool also. Quite neat. As nearly as we can tell, there are parts of at least two bodies. It's impossible at present to identify them. It's impossible even to determine the sex of the bodies or their approximate ages. And by the appearance of the bodies, the medical officer thinks that they have been dead about 2 weeks, but he doesn't know for certain. He's sorting them out now.
During the week, other parcels were discovered along the course of Garden Home Lynn and along the banks of the River Annan, all on the Scottish side of the border, outside my bailiwick. These parcels, which also contained portions of human bodies, were wrapped in pages of the Sunday Graphic for the 15th of September, and in pages of other newspapers, unidentifiable because of bloodstains. I had a telephone call.
Sergeant Bond speaking at Moffat, sir.
Oh, hello, Sergeant. What's up?
We don't think our friends are Scottish, sir.
What's that?
Don't think they're Scottish.
What friends? What?
The dead people, sir. The ones we found. We don't think they're Scottish folk.
Well, that's quite a statement, Sergeant, when you can't even tell whether they're male or female.
Well, sir, we've been making inquiries ever since the first parcel was found. And according to our records, there hasn't been anybody missing in Dumfriesshire in 11 years who's not accounted for.
Well, that doesn't prove that...
There was a carnival at Morecambe about 2 weeks before we found the...
Well, now, what's that got to do with it?
Well, I telephoned the Herald office in London, sir. And they printed a special edition of slip sheets with pictures of the Morecambe Carnival.
Oh, yes, that's right.
They printed 5,370 copies. And it was all sold with the Sunday Herald of 15 September, either in Morecambe, which is right alongside you, or in Lancaster, which is where you are, sir.
Do you mind telling me what all this has got to do with your latest discovery, Sergeant?
Oh, not at all, sir. I thought you'd understand. The latest discoveries was wrapped up in those special pages, sir.
I at once put our people onto their missing persons lists to discover what missing persons had been reported about the 15th of September who had not yet been found.
From Morecambe, sir, they've had nobody missing since September 11th, before season closed at Seaside. Two persons, trippers from York, missing on that day, but bodies were recovered on the following day. Both were drowned, that's all, sir.
How about Lancaster?
None unaccounted for within the specified period, sir. Unless you want to count this one... Though she's not really missing.
Who?
Name Maggie Rowlandson, maid servant. She's not been officially reported missing. But her stepfather's been around mumbling about a complaint.
What about?
Well, sir, it's one of them there things. The girl went away with her mistress and they haven't come back, that's all.
Where'd they go?
Edinburgh, her husband says, sir.
Oh, she's married.
Mistress, husband.
Well, tell him to make the wife send the girl back.
I did, sir. And he wrote, but... He hasn't had any reply yet. I gather the wife got fed up with him and walked out, taking the maid along for company.
Huh.
They'll be back.
That all?
That's all, sir.
Well, keep on checking up on missing persons, though what can be done, I'm sure I don't know.
No, sir.
I think that sergeant over there at Moffat's is daft. Anyone could have got hold of a copy of that special edition of the Herald.
Yes, sir.
It's his affair. Let him work it out his way. We've plenty to do.
Yes, sir.
Well, thanks very much anyway. Keep your eyes open.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I say, I suppose it is our job to check up on things.
Yes, sir, that's right.
Whether it makes much sense or not. What's this chap's name whose wife's gone? Well, I'll have a chat with him and see what can be done about getting this girl back to her parents. Fat chance, I expect.
Name's Dr. John Hakim, sir. 2 Dalton Square.
Funny name.
Hindu or Parsi or something, I think, sir.
Well, I'll go see the blighter on my way. It's quite all right. Go ahead. What here?
Sir, this is Sergeant Barnes at Moffat over in Dumfriesshire.
Hello, Barnes.
We're almost certain now, sir, about the bodies.
Certain? Well, what did you find out?
Well, sir, there's two professors of forensic medicine staying here at the hotel in Moffat from Glasgow University, sir.
Yeah.
And they were invited to look at the remains. They and the medical officer here think they can be put them back together.
Good. Then you'll be able to identify them.
Well, they're not so sure about that, sir, seeing the condition of them. But what I called you about was to tell you you can narrow down whatever search you're making there.
I was going to tell you I haven't found any persons missing here, so your theory is...
Not missing persons, sir.
What did you say?
It's missing women.
Women?
Aye. The doctors have sentenced, sir. They were both women.
I felt rather a fool about doing it. But my conscience, if that's who it was, kept mumbling in my ear about leaving no stone unturned, so I stopped my car as near to the door of 2 Dalton Place as I could and went to call on Dr. John Hakim. The bell was apparently out of order. It was a good 5 minutes before my pounding on the door was answered.
The doctor ain't home, sir.
Oh, isn't it?
He's committing an operation on an impacted wisdom tooth, sir.
Oh? Then he's a dentist.
Licentiated Dentistry, University of Bombay, sir.
I thought he was a doctor.
Bachelor of Medicine, University of Lucknow, sir.
He's an Indian.
A Parsi, sir. Whatever that is. But he won't be back till quite late, so I'm not to take any appointments for him for the day.
Are you the,
I'm the charwoman.
Well, I'm very anxious to see the doctor. I'm Captain Watt.
Mrs. Music. Mrs. Pamela Music.
Who?
That's my name, sir.
Oh. Well, I was quite anxious to see the doctor.
Well, I'm in the doctor's confidence, sir. If there was anything...
I am Chief Constable of Lancaster, Mrs. Music.
Cool. What's he done, sir?
Nothing, so far as I know.
Well, then, what do you want to see him about?
Well, I'm afraid that's my business and his, my dear madam.
Madam, be I... You want to ask him about his wife, don't you, sir?
I wonder if you could tell me anything about him.
I'm afraid that's his business and mine, my dear sir.
Will you tell the doctor, please, that I'd be glad if he'd get in touch with me at the town hall, my office?
Has Mrs. Iron Mighty Dr. Akeem been making trouble?
Why should she make trouble?
Well, she's made plenty before. Though it's not my affair, I'm sure. What's she want now, sir?
I'm afraid I shall have to discuss that with the doctor. If you'll be good enough to tell him that I called, please.
Yes, sir.
Would you know where Mrs. Hakim is at present?
I do not.
Does the doctor know?
Well, of course he knows.
And do you know if Maggie Rowlandson is with her, the maid?
Well, I know she should be right here, doing her share of this work, the lazy... Well...
How long has she been gone?
Oh, since that Sunday the carnival at Morecambe closed.
The 15th of September.
I think it was. They'd been to Morecambe that Saturday night for the last day of it.
Mrs. Harkin and the maid.
And the doctor told me when I come to work on Monday the missus had walked out on Sunday morning, taking Maggie with her. This is the longest time she's been away.
Oh, this has happened before, eh? Where does she usually go?
She's got a sister in Edinburgh. She visits...
What's her name?
Mrs. Alexander MacArthur. Darling Edie. She's a twin of Mrs. Hakim, and I don't like her. Poor dear doctor. I hope she don't never come back this time. You'll be better off.
Why?
Nag, nag, nag. And that used to be a barmaid right here in town before he met her. And him eating his heart out for her. Oh, well, you'll excuse me, sir, but I've got to get back to work. I'll tell the doctor you called, but don't you tell him what I've said now, mind you, sir. Here now, give us a hand with this carpet before you go, huh?
Express message dispatched to the Edinburgh Police by Chief Constable Lionel Watt of Lancaster.
Most urgently request you make contact with Mrs. Alexander MacArthur, Edinburgh. Requesting having her sister, Mrs. Jan Hakim of this city, get in touch with me at once. Also discover whether Mrs. Hakim's maidservant, Maggie Rowlandson, is there with her. Information most urgently desired. Watt, Chief Constable Lancaster.
Sergeant Barnes of Moffat telephoned me.
Sergeant Barnes here, sir.
Oh, good morning, Sergeant.
Good morning, sir. Did you have any luck?
We found two women who seem to be missing. Yes, Sergeant, but further inquiry has discovered them for us. They're visiting in Edinburgh, that's all. You had any luck?
Those two professors I told you about, sir. They seem quite delighted with what they've accomplished.
Putting the bodies back together.
Bodies? You should have seen them, sir.
I did, thanks. Any clues?
They said one of the bodies was a young woman. The others older, about 35, Dr. Fairley said. The young one, he said.
Red hair?
Yes, sir. And there's a part of the upper left forearm of the younger one that can't be found.
What's that mean, Barnes?
Well, Dr. Fairley thinks there was some kind of identifying mark.
Oh.
A scar or something. And the murderer, whoever he was smart enough to remove it. Real neat. Professional job, too, sir. Just as neat as if a doctor or a surgeon had done it, Dr. Fairley says.
Come in.
Dr. Hawkins, sir.
What?
Dr. Hawkins here.
Oh. I have him come in, please.
What do you say, sir?
I've got a visitor, Barnes.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir.
I'll talk to you later. Goodbye.
Goodbye, sir.
Well, sir.
You are Chief Constable Watt, isn't it?
I am, sir.
I want to know what you mean, sir, by persecuting me. Answer me.
Why, my dear sir, nobody's persecuting
you. You have appeared at my office in my absence making inquiries, which I am resenting very much indeed. And I demand that they be stopped.
My dear man.
I am a reputable doctor, sir, a surgeon. I will not have policemen coming to my office.
I came to your home, sir.
It is also my office and surgery. You are thinking that I have some guilty knowledge of my wife's whereabouts and that little Rundy, her maid, isn't it?
There's no call to be quite so belligerent, Dr.
I shall be as belligerent as I please, sir, when my rights are invaded.
Now, look here, Dr. Hakim. I am not going to be put on the defensive by you at all. You may as well understand that. Now, I'm sure that you're aware that I'm following up a legitimate inquiry concerning the whereabouts of your maid, Maggie.
You have no right to question my servants.
My dear sir, I have a right to question anyone who might be able to contribute information.
You know that Mrs. Music will talk.
I am not acquainted with Mrs. Music's proclivities, sir. Now that you are here in my office, I ask you what information you can give me about the Rowlandson woman.
I can give you none. She accompanied my wife to Glasgow. Probably she is still there with her.
I thought you said that your wife went to Edinburgh.
Edinburgh, I mean. I can't keep these stupid Scottish... The English says these Scottish... I can't remember them.
I see. Has your wife left you, Doctor?
I will not tell you.
You have a reason for refusing to answer, I take it.
I have. You will be telling it all over the city and my practice will be ruined. I know how you police operate. I don't trust you.
That's a very extraordinary attitude to take,
It is
Doctor.
The attitude which I choose to take. You will stop meddling with my affairs, sir.
Look here, Dr. Hakim. Dr. Hakim. I have no interest for the moment in the reasons for your wife's having left you, but...
I'll tell you why she left me. She left me for another man.
I said I have no interest in her reason, sir, at the moment.
I'm being disgraced. I am being ruined by this scandal. My practice, I should be ruined. And now you please come around so that all the neighbors may see. It is inexcusable.
Oh, control yourself, sir. I'm interested in finding Maggie Rowlandson for her parents.
She is with my wife in Glasgow, Edinburgh.
Is she?
Of course I told you so. Now, will you do something to end this persecution?
I've told you there is no persecution, Doctor.
Will you put a notice in the papers that I had nothing to do with my wife's leaving me? Will you swear?
You're being silly, Doctor.
No, you are ruining my practice.
I don't believe so,
Doctor. I demand that you give out a statement to the public that I know nothing at all about this.
Except that you know where your wife and Miss Rowlandson are.
Will you give me a statement, sir?
Dr. Hawking, when I'm thoroughly convinced that you have no connection with either your wife's going away nor of Miss Rowlandson's unexplained departure...
I had nothing to do with either of them. My wife left me and took Maggie with her.
When I'm thoroughly convinced of that, Doctor, I'll be glad to say so to any of your patients, present or prospective, that you care to send me.
How dare you?
Until then, if I need you, I shall send for you. Good day, sir.
You are persecuting me because I'm an Indian, isn't it?
You are being offensive, sir.
You think you are a great big superior Englishman and so on.
Yes,
therefore,
sir.
You can... What do you want?
Sergeant, show Dr. Hakim the exit, please.
Yes, sir. Will you come this way?
I will not come this way. I want justice. I will stay here until... All right. I'm coming. You're bigger than I am. You're English. You
exit
bully.
This way, sir.
Ratty little brute. Oh, hello. Put me through to Sergeant Barnes over in Moffat in Dumfriesshire, if you please. Right. Dumfriesshire is in Scotland. Right.
He's gone, sir.
Oh, excuse me, sir. I had this express message for you when you rang for me. From Edinburgh.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I'll wait. Edinburgh.
Barnes here.
Oh, Sergeant Barnes, what here? I was just calling to tell you that... First, though, have you heard anything more in the way of clues? You were starting to tell me...
Just that we found that one of the pieces of the body, sir, was wrapped up in a pair of child's rompers, sir.
Rompers?
Yes, sir. The other parts were wrapped up in old papers, old rags, a bit of sheeting. But this, it appears to be a part of a left leg, was wrapped up in these kids' rompers. That's all. So if that'll help, what did you find out, sir?
Well, I had this chap in here, and a remarkably unpleasant little man. He confirms that both of our so-called missing women are safe in Edinburgh. So I'm afraid that your Lancaster theory rather collapses.
Oh, that's too bad, sir. I had great hopes of you taking this off our hands.
No, I think not. As a matter of fact, I've just had an express message from the Edinburgh police. I'll read it to you. Half a sec. Chief Constable, etc., etc., that's me.
What do they say, sir?
Well, I'm afraid I gave it back rather too quickly, Sergeant.
You what, sir?
Here's the message from Edinburgh. Subject person has been contacted. Says has not seen subject of inquiry, Mrs. Hakim, since last New Year's Day in Lancaster. Has never seen subject Maggie Rowlandson. Hodson...
That's
Edinburgh,
fine.
Please. What'd you say, Sergeant?
I said, I wish you luck, sir.
It was raining quite hard when I arrived, full of beans, at the door of number 2 Dalton Square to demand explanations from the little doctor. I thumped the door vigorously and... After a suitable period of time, it opened.
The doctor ain't in. Oh, it's you, Constable.
Where is he, Mrs. Musey?
Out, sir. Calling on patients. He certainly did give me what for.
May I come in out of the rain, please?
Oh, if you must,
thank
sir.
You.
Wipe your boots on the mat. It's mucky enough in here anyways, though Lord knows I try to keep it tidy. What do you want now? She ain't here. Neither one of them's here.
Neither Mrs. Hakim nor Maggie, what's her name, Rowlandson?
Nor the doctor. Now, what did you want, sir? He ain't here.
It's very important that I see him. Where do you expect I might find him? Or when will he be back?
That's the way I got into trouble the other day, answering questions.
Now, look here, Mrs. Music.
He says it ain't good for business. He said if I'd done it again, I'd lose me situation, and I'm not going to lose me situation.
If you'll just tell me when the doctor will be back, Mrs. Music.
He'll be back tonight. He's going to have tea with the children.
What children?
Oh, no, lovey, how it's raining. Well, that'll be good for the carpets.
Carpets?
Oh, now, you do ask questions, don't you?
What children?
The doctors. They're staying with Dr. Mattoon and his wife since the missus went away. That's why the carpets are soaking in the rain.
Mrs. Music, will you please...
To wash the blood out of them.
What blood?
It's been on them ever since the day she went away, and I don't know any way to get it out, so I'm soaking them in the rain.
Whose blood? Whose blood is it, I mean?
There was blood all over the surgery and on the stair carpet. You helped me with the stair carpet yesterday, for which I thank you, sir.
Whose blood?
Huh? Blood ain't no treat around here, sir. The doctor's always cutting people up, committing operations and all.
Whose blood, I say?
Oh, you needn't yell at me. I can hear all right. Why, his, of course.
His? The doctor's?
Of course.
How did his blood get on?
When I come to work that Monday morning, he told me the missus had run away from him, so he took the kids to stay with Mrs. Mattoon, like I said before. And when he come back, he tried to open a tin of peaches for his breakfast, and he cut his hand dreadful on the tin opener. Didn't you see he was still bandaged up?
Yes, yes.
There was blood every place in the house. On the rug, on his waistcoat.
He bled a lot.
You wouldn't think one person could bleed so much and still walk about.
Who dressed his hand?
He dressed it himself. He wouldn't even let me put Zambuk on it. He's very accomplished, sir. Oh, dear me.
What's the matter?
Oh, I knowed he'd forget to take them. You see?
What are those things?
Oh, I told him he'd forget them. Now, what are those poor kiddies going to do with them?
What are they?
Rompers. Don't you recognize rompers? Haven't you got any kiddies? I told him to take them.
Whose are they?
All except that one pair that belonged to young Alan. I don't know how anybody could lose a pair of rompers.
Is there a telephone here, Mrs. Music?
In the surgery there, but I'm not sure the doctor
was... There's half a crown. Say nothing about it.
You are Bar Music, that red bow tie he's been wanting.
In here, Mrs. Music?
It's his birthday Wednesday. What'd you say? Hell, yes, it's in there, sir. Thank you.
One more question, Mrs. Music. What color hair did Maggie Rowlandson have?
Had, sir? Well, she's got ginger hair. Real bright red.
Thank you, Mrs. Music. This is Chief Constable Watt. Put me through to Sergeant Barnes at the Moffat Police Station. Quickly, do you hear? It was 8 o'clock in the evening when Sergeant Barnes arrived at 2 Dalton Place. I'd urged Mrs. Music to wait. Come in, Barnes, I said. Did you bring them?
Yes, sir, they're right here.
What on earth?
Know what these are, Mrs. Music?
Well, of course I do. Where'd you get them all bloody like this? Ugh. Is there blood on everything?
What are they?
Why, they're little Alan's rompers that was lost.
How do you know?
Well, right there. The patch I sewed on myself out of Music Sanderson gingham shirt. Of course I know. Where'd you get them?
Why, Miss Maggie Rowlandson had them.
Oh, well, there's the doctor. At last. You gentlemen, you can...
Mrs. Music, are you here?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
I'm here also, Dr. Hakim.
Now, what are you wanting in my house?
I want to see you, sir.
And may I know who you are, please?
I'm Sergeant Barnes of the Dumfriesshire Constabulary, sir. I want to see you, too.
Now, look here. What is this?
They found little Alan's rompers that was lost, Doctor. Aren't you glad?
No, I don't think he's very glad, Mrs. Music. Doctor, may I look at that bandaged hand where you cut it on the tin opener and where you bled so profusely?
Stand away from me. Stand away from me, I tell you.
Hold his hand, Barnes.
Yes, sir.
Don't touch my hand. Let go.
I'll be quite gentle, Doctor, but I've got to get that bandage off. There's no blood here. Now, there. Look, Barnes.
Yes, sir.
What? Let me see. Why the right knee cut on that hand? Well, where did all the blood come from, then?
Yes, Doctor. Where did all the blood come from? Johangir Sohrabik Hakim, alias Dr. John Hakim, I arrest you for the murder of your common law wife and of Maggie Rowlandson. And I warn you that anything you say will be taken down in writing and may be used in evidence. He admitted it, finally. He had murdered his wife in a fit of insane rage when he discovered that she had met, quite innocently, incidentally, the man of whom he was insanely jealous, though without any cause whatever. The maid, Maggie Rowlandson, was killed in an attempt to defend her mistress. In one day, the murders had been committed on Saturday night. He had dissected the bodies, removed all means of identification, and at night had scattered the neatly wrapped parcels containing the bodies from the bridge on the Edinburgh Road. The two professors from the university were able to reassemble the mangled bits to such an extent that there was no question of their identity at last. Dr. Hakim, which was not his name, was tried for murder at Manchester Assizes and found guilty. He was hanged at Strangeways Prison 3 weeks later. Same hangman who works for Scotland Yard officiated.
Heard in the order of their appearance on Whitehall 1212 today were Harvey Hayes, Horace Braham, Pat O'Malley, Lester Fletcher, Patricia Courtley, and Morris Delamore. Lionel Rico speaking. Whitehall 1212 is written and directed by Willis Cooper. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
That's Whitehall, 1212 from May 25th, 1952, with the case of Maggie Rowlandson. And Willis Cooper produced that, directed it, and created it. And it's heard on NBC.
You know, I had a couple people text in and ask me what a romper is.
Yeah, it's
a
like
wrapper, a little
a,
kid's like a one-piece.
Sleepy, right? You sleep in it, like, right?
Well, you
kid
could,
sleeps in
but
it.
But you could go out in a romper, just like a one-piece, like
remember
shorts
romper
and a top.
Room?
Romper room. I
remember
see,
that?
I see
Lisa. I see Carl. I see Shante.
I see a magic mirror. Of course, it's romper room.
Don't forget, 5 free classic radio shows. We have Suspense, Jack Benny, Gunsmoke, Richard Diamond, Private Detective, Fibber McGee and Molly. Complete shows, 30-minute episodes at 100radioshows.com. They're yours free as a thank you for listening to the show. And if there's anything there you want to purchase, because there's hundreds of other shows available for purchase, use the promo code RADIO at checkout. Save 70%. That's also a thank you for listening to this radio show. In our next hour, it's The Lives of Harry Lime, Orson Welles, Lisa. Remember? You know, I sometimes say, oh, Welles.
Oh, Wells.
Oh, Wells. He stars in a 1951 broadcast, The Lives of Harry Lime. That is coming your way in just a few minutes right here. All right. This is our...
Three.
Hour three?
Hour three.
It is?
It is. We've got The Lives of Harry Lime from Hour Three. This is from September 14th, 1951.
Oh,
Love
right.
Affair with Orson Welles. And we will be playing our new... exciting segment called Just the Facts.
You know, you're right. It is Hour Three.
How do you like that? Once in a while, I get
it
right.
I'm all confused.
Well,
I'm
so
all
what's new
confused.
With that?
I don't know, but I am. Hey, you know what, Lisa? Did you get your links? For,
yes, I did.
What'd you think?
You know what? I'm usually a little bit behind.
Yeah, you're behind, all right.
I'm a little bit behind.
You're a little
I haven't
little
actually
bit.
Gotten to the new month's links, but I have them.
You haven't listened to
I have
to
a
the...
special folder
yeah.
where I am building my own classic radio collection every month.
Very good. And you know, the best thing... I was thinking about this the other day. The Classic Radio Club, and we have hundreds and hundreds of members. The Classic Radio Club, it's so great to experience it. If you are not a Classic Radio Club member, folks, you can go to our website, classicradioclub.com, and you can join for $1. Just $1, and you join, and you can experience being a club member. Now, you'll get 10 classic radio shows emailed to you, including Abbott Costello with the Who's On First and Suspense and Jack Benny, Gunsmoke, Inner Sanctum. Great shows. And then every month you will get whatever 10 shows we're sending. I pick 10 shows from my library of 100,000 shows and send those to you each and every month. Now, the first month, $1. If you get the digital downloads, it's only $9.99. So $1 a show. And if you get the CDs, it's a little more, $14.99, but that's 5 CDs in a collector case, and you get them sent to your door.
And that's 10 classic radio shows
yeah,
on the CDs. 5 CDs.
Plus liner notes. I write about every show. Not only the show you're getting, but the series itself.
And, of course, I get the liner notes on my digital option as well. So I get an email. It has all of the links on the email and the liner notes to go along with it. So either way, you can't lose.
Right. You get the same 10 shows, whether you join the digital program or the CD set. But, you know, some people like CDs. Some people like the digital.
Tomato, tomato, yeah. Carl, you know?
But it's a great... I mean, if you like classic radio, these shows... When I tell you they are pristine quality, the best quality shows we have. Plus, I always pick interesting programs and certain reasons why. I talk about it in the liner notes. But you will get the best of the best each and every month being a Classic Radio Club member. So check it out. Go to classicradioclub.com. Yeah?
All right. Good job.
When we come back, we're going to play our game, Just the Facts, and then it's The Lives of Harry Lime. Stick around. That gets your attention, doesn't it, that
sure
music?
It does. Glad I
Ladies
thought of it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you're about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect the...
Too bad he doesn't say the stories. The
That's
stories,
right.
Because it's more than one story.
Yes, it is. Just to let everybody know and remind everybody, we are no longer doing Guess That Song. A lot of texts. We appreciated all of the support, but it's time to put it behind us. We're moving on. It's Just the Facts. Just the Facts is chock full of facts and history and trivia from the year of the radio show that we'll be playing that hour. This hour, we're going to be playing a show from 1951, The Lives of Harry Lime. So we're going to be talking a little bit about what happened back in 1951. Of course, just the facts. So in 1951, and I know you know about this, Carl, MGM owed the dog who played Lassie $40,000 in back pay. Didn't we talk about that once? So not planning.
Boy, MGM really went to the dogs, huh?
Went to the dogs. So not planning any more Lassie movies, MGM instead gave the rights to the Lassie trademark to the dog's trainer.
Yeah,
who spun it off
into Weatherwax.
Okay, something like that.
Yeah.
Who spun it off into a TV show that ran for 19 seasons.
They were probably happy. He was probably happy that they got the rights back.
I would think so. Let's hear a little bit about the opening of Lassie.
Lassie!
Remember the show? Did you watch Lassie?
Yeah, and it airs on antenna TV all the time.
It does, yes.
Starring June Lockhart.
So this
Hugh
ran,
Riley,
this TV show ran for 19
John
seasons
Bobo
from 1954
Timmy.
To
how
70.
Many seasons?
19.
Get the heck out
yeah,
of here.
Yeah, I know. Okay, I'm out.
19 seasons?
Yeah, 54 to 73.
So that the dog would have been 140 years old. Because it's 7 years for every year. It's 140 almost.
Well, they may have not just used one dog. That's just how it works in the TV
not
world.
In the show. It was always the same dog.
Always the same dog. So also in 1951, Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah, Joe DiMaggio.
Yeah, the Yankee Clipper.
Yes.
He had a 56-game hitting streak
and did
not strike out during the 1951 season.
No, that's impossible.
No, that's...
He had to have struck out at least once in 1951.
That's incorrect, Carl.
These
are the facts, Carl. Just the facts, I'm giving them to you.
If that's true... That's probably a record that no one will ever break. He maybe didn't strike out
me?
In the 51 hits.
In the 51 season.
Yeah, the 1951 season.
That's what I said.
He had like 300 at-bats. He didn't strike out?
My facts tell me that Joe DiMaggio did not strike out during the 1951
if
season.
If that is true, that is a mind-boggling
all right, you'll have
statistic.
To, you'll
I'll
have
tell you
to
that right
that
now.
Out.
Okay.
Also, that year...
Our experts listening will let
okay,
us know.
Okay, that would be great. The Broadway show The King and I premiered in March of 51 at Broadway St. James Theater, ran for nearly 3 years.
Yul Brynner.
Yeah.
The King and I.
That's right. You know something about shows, making it the fourth longest running Broadway musical in history at that time.
Yeah.
Let's hear a little clip from that.
Shall we dance?
1, 2, 3, and.
On a bright cloud of music, shall we fly?
1, 2, 3, and.
Shall we dance?
Have you
1, 2, 3,
have
and.
Have you seen The King and I?
1, 2, 3,
yeah,
and.
It's iconic.
1, 2, 3,
no.
No, that gives you a little insight into 1951. Yes. Indeed.
All right. Well, good job, Lisa.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Carl.
Wow. We have a text in line, 312-981-7200. We love hearing from you. And any of this stuff sparks a memory or two, let us know about that, too.
Yeah.
We love reading about your lives. So text us, and this segment is brought to you by Cat's Pride. But right now it's time for The Lives of Harry Lime, a good drama that starred Orson Welles as Harry Lime. Came to radio in 1951. It was produced in London. At this time, Lisa, Orson Welles, I think, was avoiding some tax problems here in the United States, and he moved to London to get away from all that those problems. And he
did it work?
I don't know. And he starred in two radio shows. You know, he had to make some money out there. You know, he liked to eat.
Don't
and
we
so
all?
So he starred in two radio series while he was in London, and one of them was The Black Museum.
Right.
The other was The Lives of Harry Lime, both by the same producer, Harry Allen Towers. This was all about, you know, this character was all about the third man, from the Graham Greene novel, The Third Man. There was a movie, and Lime was shot and killed in the sewer beneath Vienna in the original film. So the radio series was a prequel.
Right.
Many adventures of con artist Lime were told in this series in sort of a lighter tone. And the Third Man theme was played on a zither by Anton Karas for this radio show, as it was in the movie as well. And we have an episode for you now called Love Affair from September 14th, 1951. Orson Welles stars. Now, uninterrupted, here is The Lives of Harry Lime.
Thank you.
presenting Orson Welles as the Third Man. The Lives of Harry Lime. The fabulous stories of the immortal character originally created in the motion picture The Third Man, with zither music by Anton Kara.
That was the shot that killed Harry Lime. He died in a sewer beneath Vienna, as those of you know who saw the movie The Third Man. Yes, that was the end of Harry Lime. But it was not the beginning. Harry Lime had many lives, and I can recount all of them. How do I know? It's very simple. Because my name is Harry Lime. Friends, the story of my marriage, my first marriage, and believe you me, my last. It all began in the funny little city of Becurata. There isn't much to do there except get married. Principal local occupation, of course, is getting rich, and that's what brought me to Becurata. It's hidden away, as you probably know, in a remote corner of Saudi Arabia. Mines of black gold, oil derricks dot the landscape as far as you can see, and huddled beneath these modern steel skeletons lies a city as old as the East. Curio dealers hawk their wares in the narrow winding streets. Beggars doze in shadowed doorways. Robed Arabs mingle with Europeans in soiled whites. And the city drowses with all the indolence of Asia. An ideal place for a murder and a double cross in oil. Oil to grease the skids of fortune for Harry Lime.
And now Orson Welles as Harry Lime, the third man in Love Affair.
Becurata, Saudi Arabia. Harry Lime, that's me. A happy young bachelor strolling along the narrow street that led from the Grand Hotel to the native bazaar.
O noble one, a moment of your time.
I'm sorry, friend.
I am not a beggar, O heaven-born. I am teller of fortune.
Yes, but
the past, the present, the future. I see all,
yes,
I tell all.
Very interesting,
oh,
sure.
Greatest of great lords, may your back never bend.
Oh, thank you.
May your beard never grow white.
Well, I'll try not to. Thank
a
you.
A little backsheesh, and I read your fortune.
Thanks very much, old man. I'm busy making my fortune. I don't need to have it told.
Show me your palm, noble one. Let me but see the line of your destiny.
Okay, okay, friend, but make it snappy.
Ah, the hand of the wanderer, the seeker. It is difficult to tell your fortune, my lord, because you have no fortune.
Oh?
You have many fortune.
Well, that's nice to hear, old man, but let's get down to cases. When am I going to get rich?
You will always be near to wealth and see many women.
Oh, that's good.
Beautiful women.
Oh, that's better.
Dark women.
I like blondes, too.
But only one wife.
Also redheads. What's that about a wife?
Noble one, you will only be married once.
Well, and once is too much. To put it mildly, I'm afraid you've got your fortunes mixed up.
You will travel, great one, quickly and across many lands. And you travel with wife.
Okay, now you've had your fun. I'll say goodbye.
Wait! Wait! You have not paid me.
Why should I, friend? I'm Harry Lime, but you don't know about me. It'd fill a book, and nobody's going to write it without paying me royalties. So long, old man.
Still the same sweet, generous Harry Lime.
Schweig, what are you doing in Becurata?
Just exactly what you think I'm doing, checking up on you.
The same sweet, lovable Carl Schweig.
Where can we talk, eh?
Almost anywhere. It's the time for salat. No one to bother us. Come on, go into this cafe here.
It doesn't look very clean.
It'll answer your needs, don't you think? You follow me?
Well, it doesn't seem to be anyone around.
What do you want, Schweig?
What do I want? I want to know whether you've obtained the oil leases. That is what you're being paid for, isn't it, Mr. Lyon?
Not too well paid, I'm sorry.
Quit toying with me, Harry.
I'm not toying with you. What do you expect? Everything in this city moves by inches. I've made friends here. I'm real chummy with Alifan. I think I've got him in a receptive mood. Actually, I'm sure he doesn't realize how important oil is going to be here in a few years. If I can't force him to sign in a minute, things don't work that way.
I know. We have perfect confidence in him.
And why did you come here?
To make sure that our confidence wasn't misplaced.
Oh, I see.
And do you think you might be able to settle the matter of the oil leases?
I have an appointment with the Elephant late this afternoon. He's out at his summer palace now. It's about 40 miles from the city. When I get back, I'll get in touch with you. You'll be at the Grand Hotel, I guess.
I'll be gone by this afternoon, Harry, but I do have others working for me. I'll know it if you try to double-cross me.
Your government will get the leases, Schweig. How about the money?
I brought you a draft to pay for your services to date. Here.
Yeah. And thank you. Oh, hey, what's this? Yeah, this hardly covers my hotel bill. My fair getting here. You're trying to...
Your final payment will be waiting for you at the Bank International when you have concluded negotiations.
But how will anyone at the bank know when I...
They'll know, Harry. They'll know.
I was still burning about the size of the checks. I left Schweig and headed for the Bank International. I hadn't been surprised to learn that Schweig's government had other agents in Decorada, but I wondered how it was possible for someone employed by the bank to know when the Alifan had acceded to my requests. As I entered the shabby monument to finance, I searched the bland, inscrutable faces behind the cages, but they told me nothing. Well, I'd come to cash the check, not play charades. I slid the infuriating little piece of engraved paper through the opening of the window of the chief teller, a lovely-looking lad, if you care for the pockmarked, beady-eyed, murderous type. He glanced down at the check and then up at me.
You are Harry Lyon?
Yes, I have my credentials.
That won't be necessary. You are already well known in this city.
Oh, that's very flattering.
How did you want this, Mr. Lyon?
I don't care about the denominations, but I wanted an American money.
American money?
Yeah, you see, I'm an American. I'm sentimental about American money.
Very well, Mr. Lyon. Mm. Here you are, sir. $500.
Thank you.
However, with the current rate of exchange, I might advise you to...
Pardon me, Mr. Lyme.
Huh?
I apologize for approaching you on the street, but I must speak to you at once.
Who are you?
My name would not mean anything to you, but I can tell you this. I am no friend of Carl Schweig.
Oh, that's good. Any enemy of Carl Schweig is a friend of mine. What can I do for you?
It is a matter of what I can do for you. To begin with, may I drive you back to your hotel?
I have my own car.
You do not own a car, Mr. Lyme, and the Citroën you have rented, you did not use today. You left it in the hotel garage to be serviced. You want it in good running order for your trip to the Alafin Summer Palace later in the day.
Mm-hmm. I'd be delighted to accept a lift back to the hotel. That's your car there?
Yes. Gregory? A car is my own, incidentally. There are some governments that are not as cautious of their purse strings as the employers of your Mr. Schweig. Gregory, we will drive Mr. Lyme to the Grand Hotel. Do not hurry.
Well, old man, you know all about my car, my engagement this afternoon, apparently my business here in Decorada. What more would you like to know?
You do me an injustice, Mr. Lyme. I do not seek anything. I wish to give you something here.
What do you want kidnapped for this kind of money?
Mr. Lyme, we are both here in Decorata for the same thing, but there are two major differences. You want the oil leases for the country who gave you that check you just cashed at the bank. I want the leases for another power.
Mm-hmm, yes.
To date, you have been successful, and I have not been.
I have no signed agreements,
you
man.
You will have. Authoritative sources tell me that it has become a personal thing between you and the Alafin. You have exercised great charm on him. He will sign the leases made out by you to whatever power you select.
Maybe.
I want you to make out the contracts for my country.
Yeah, but Schweig's already given me several payments.
Payments? How do they compare with the money you now hold in your hand?
Well, they don't compare, but I can't accept this money. I've already assured Schweig...
Look, Harry Lyme, I know you. I know how your mind works. I have worked with men like you for years. Your loyalties belong to the highest bidder. In your hand, you hold the largest price yet offered for your services. When you present the contracts to the Alafin tomorrow, I am sure they will contain the name of the right country.
A minute later, I was walking toward the bar of the hotel. I wasn't clutching the money the Baron had offered me in my tight little fist anymore. I was making a comforting bulge in my wallet. The long mahogany gate to forgetfulness was deserted except for George Harris. George is a sort of glorified tourist guide who sometimes brought parties of American travelers to see the quaint charm of ancient Decorata. Quaint yet.
I'm not crowding, am I, Lyme?
You were here first, so you couldn't be crowding me.
All right, then you're crowding me, and it's a long bar.
If there's anything silly looking, it's a long bar with one drinker at one end, one at the other. Come on, Harris, break down. Have a drink with me.
Lyme, it may interest you to know that when I bring tourists here, I give them a little indoctrination lecture.
Oh, I suppose.
And part of it consists of a warning to keep away from a very unsavory American expatriate by the name of Harry Lyme.
You think I'm capable of contaminating you and your camera-toting babbits?
I don't quite know what you're capable of, but the tourists who can afford to include a side trip to the Orient in their itinerary obviously have money. There's no sense in waving a branch of honeysuckle in front of a bee.
Well, I guess that's my cue to buzz off, Mr. Harris. Don't worry about my trying to get even with you for all the nasty things you said. I'd much rather have my revenge when you're not prepared for it. I wasn't hungry, but I walked into the dining saloon. George Harris followed me, headed for a table festooned with his party of tourists. Usually his party consisted of bicarbonate of soda addicts, fugitives from board of directors meetings, and generously proportioned dowagers enjoying the money their late husbands had worked themselves to death accumulating. But this time, there was a new note. A lovely, fresh-looking girl. She had the sort of innocence that only a Reynolds could have captured, or a Harry Lime. When she got up from the table, I followed her to the piazza. There wasn't a hovering mother, a chaperone, or a tourist guide in sight.
You didn't drop your handkerchief.
What?
If you had, I could have picked it up and returned it to you. We could have started talking. I would have offered to show you the city.
I have a guide, thank you.
Yes, I know, but I could show you places George Harris wouldn't dream of taking a 17-year-old girl to.
I'm 19.
Now, I've been wondering about a few other things, too, as a matter of fact.
You must be the Harry Lime Mr. Harris was telling us about.
Oh, surely I'm not the only man in Becerrata capable of speculating a bit about a beautiful American girl.
I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Lime, but the others will be coming out from lunch soon, and I mustn't be seen talking to you here in broad daylight.
But it won't be broad daylight forever. Well, then, perhaps we'll meet this evening, Miss...
Perhaps.
Girl was a real looker. But with all the looks, she was pushed to the back of my mind as I got to the summer palace of the Elephant later that afternoon. My rented Citroën was behaving nicely, and I guess I wasn't watching the road too carefully because suddenly the ordinarily deserted strip of pavement became crowded and I had to pull to a stop. Arabs riding burros crowded about the car. There were some half-castes on foot climbing on the running boards. In front of the car were three or four Bedouins, pretty fierce-looking customers with old-fashioned muskets slung over their shoulders. Hey, what's all this about? I'm on my way to see your ruler. If I'm detained, you'll be very angry. I say, isn't there somebody here who speaks English?
I speak English, Mr.
Well, you're the chief teller from the Bank International.
That's one of my occupations. Move over, Mr. Lime. We have many things to talk about before you have your meeting with the Alafi.
And now, Orson Welles, as the third man, continues with Love Affair.
The beady-eyed, pockmarked Arab was sitting next to me on the front seat of my rented Citroën. The near equatorial afternoon was growing cold, the leather of the car's upholstery damp and clammy under my hand. As the motley crew outside the car crowded close, I made an instinctive gesture toward the bulgy wallet that rested in my inside pocket.
If you're thinking of reaching for a gun, Mr. Lime, I might inform you that these few friends represent only a portion of Mr. Schweig's representatives in Becerrata.
So you're Schweig's man in the bank?
Precisely.
Well, you can relax. I wasn't reaching for a gun.
I have no need to relax, Mr. Lime. But you appear a trifle nervous.
Oh, no, not at all.
But perhaps your gesture towards your pocket was only to assure yourself that your wallet was still safe.
What are you getting at?
I saw you get into Mordecai Varin's car outside the bank today. It would not be healthy to go against Mr. Schweig's wishes.
No, I have no intention of doing that.
I thought the idea might have occurred.
No, not for a minute.
If Monsieur Varin's offer was more interesting... Don't try it, Mr. Lime. Keep your promise to Schweig. And then get out of town before Varin knows you've completed our arrangements with the Alafin.
I'm not leaving town till I get the balance of the money Schweig owes me. He said he'd be waiting for me at the bank.
And so it will be.
And the bank will be closed by the time I leave the Elephant's Palace.
Well, you conclude the negotiations and then meet me at the bar of the hotel.
Okay.
I will have the money waiting for you there.
All right, old man. It's a deal.
And don't try any tricks. If you do, I will know about it before you have finished counting the money.
My meeting with the high potentate of Becerrata was an infuriating ordeal of delay. Somehow or other, the granting of oil rights seemed to be inexorably tied up with native dances and ceremonies and rituals, but the best I could manage was to leave the contracts with him and get in exchange a half-promise that he would sign them. I wondered if Schweig's fascinating messenger boy would be content with the arrangements. He was waiting for me there, all right.
I came prepared, but I have been informed that the Alafin did not sign the contracts.
Look, if you know they weren't signed, you also know I made them out the way you wanted them, in favor of the Paar Schweigen you represent. My job here is finished. Even if I wanted to stick in Bikkurata until the old Dola gets around to signing them, I couldn't. Not with Baron in town. I want the money. I've got it coming to me. Now, do you understand? Now.
I'm not sure Schweig would approve.
You've got the money in your side pocket. I can see the bulge. Now pull it out and start...
Watch out, Lime. Baron knows...
Dead almost before I reached over and took the money from his side pocket. I could hear him topple from his chair as Baron, and a handful of thugs burst into the room through the doorway. Each one of them had shot him. They fired after me as I streaked out of the back door, and I reached the rear of the hotel and jumped into the Citroën. Stepped on the start, and as the motor caught, I clashed the gears. The car leaped toward a narrow, tortuous street. I wasn't sure where it led, but already I could hear other cars starting behind me. Natives and animals sprang out of my way as I careened down the winding street. The cars were further away now, but ahead of me, I could see people milling about near a dimly lit cafe. There was a figure in white. Suddenly, I could see there was the girl, the American girl from the hotel. I don't know why, but something made me stop.
Lime, help me, help me.
Oh, jump in.
Get me away from here quickly.
Hold on. Out of the way. Watch out. What were you doing in the native quarter?
George Harris wouldn't take me where I wanted to go, and I wanted to see the places you spoke about this afternoon. So I slipped out of the hotel after dinner, and I went to that native cafe back there. A horrible place. Two natives came up to my table, and I started to sneak out, and they followed me. Oh, I was never so happy to see anyone in my life.
That's all right, honey. I'll take care of you. You'll be all right. But I can't call you 19 years old, an American girl.
Well... My name's Marion Lawrence.
Hello, Marion.
I'm an orphan, and a distant relative of mine died a few months ago and left me a little money. So I quit my job and decided to take a world cruise.
And to George Harris?
No, I didn't take one of those planned cruises. I just happened to join the conducted tour to Bikkurata last weekend, and I wish I'd never come now.
You better send a wire to Harris, though. He might notify your relatives or someone if you don't show up back at the hotel.
Well, there's no one to notify. I have no relatives or friends over here.
Mm-hmm. Have your passport with you?
No, I haven't.
Well, I know someone near the border who's very talented as an engraver. However, we might obviate a lot of trouble by having him make out your passports with some new names. Say, Mr. and Mrs. Joe Smith of Cleveland, Ohio. That might do for both of us. How's that sound to you?
Sounds real exciting. Like we were spies or espionage agents or something.
Working perfectly. Marion was enthralled with the excitement and the romance of our adventure. It would take time for Varen, whoever else might be following me, to pick up the trail. But by the time we'd crossed the border, all of that was changed. Marion and I were Mr. and Mrs. Joe Smith of Cleveland, Ohio, USA. Oh, yes, it was working perfectly because, as far as I could tell, Marion was the perfect bride, adoring, starry-eyed, and really in love with me. Because she was in love with me, she asked no embarrassing questions. It was an added feature, too. It had become apparent that her little inheritance wasn't so little at all. Her purse contained a roll of large denomination bills, big enough to choke a custom official.
Did I embarrass you, dear, insisting on paying for my own clothes?
Oh, no, you didn't embarrass me at all. But I'm constantly being surprised to find that you can buy Parisian models almost anywhere in the world if you have the money.
Do you think it's safe traveling by car? Don't you think maybe we'd better leave it and take a train, Harry?
I told you to get in the habit of calling me Joe.
Sorry.
Why shouldn't I be safe? What are you hinting at?
Oh, nothing. It's just that you told me the car was rented, and I thought...
Well, stop thinking. Oh, I'm sorry, Marion, old girl. Nerves, I guess. The nerves lasted all that week as we crossed border after border. Bikkurata was a long way back now, but I still kept imagining that I saw Varen and... crowds as we went through custom offices. I thought I caught a glimpse of Schweig as we ate dinner in a funny little restaurant in Istanbul. Even though I'd seen him die, I could have sworn I saw the pockmarked face of the chief teller of the Banque Internationale as we walked into a railroad office in Bucharest. By the time we'd reached Vienna, I think I'd almost begun to enjoy my role as the somewhat bucolic tourist.
Are you happy, Joe?
Dangerously. The way I feel, I might never want to leave here.
I'd hate to think of what all this rich food would do to my figure if we stayed.
I suppose neither of us ever ordered anything more to eat or drink.
Well, it sounds as though there's plenty for all of us.
Harris.
George Harris.
You don't mind if I join you?
You talk like a cop, old man.
I'm with the FBI of the United States. By the way, Harry Lime, I think you might be interested in knowing that the Elephant got a little tired of all your intrigue the day after you left. He awarded the oil leases to the U.S.
So then Schweig's after me, too. What charges have you got against me?
Charges? We have no charges against you. It still isn't against the law to be a skunk.
Well, if there are no charges against me, I...
I've just been helping the Becurata authorities track down your sweet little bride.
Why? Marry?
I'm sorry, Harry.
The night you picked her up in Becurata, she was fleeing from the hotel where she just shot and killed her aging husband. You ready to leave, Marion?
Yes.
Just a minute. Marion, I want to get this straight.
It's no use talking, Harry. What he says is true.
You mean that's why you came away with me? You mean I was the sucker you've been using?
No,
me? Okay, I've been a lot of things in my life. I've even been married. Now, I've even been a sucker. But that's one that doesn't go in the book. But, George, I don't see how you traced us.
The big bills your wife spent on the trip. You see, her doting husband, not you, the one she killed, cashed a large check at the Banque Internationale a few hours before she did away with him. Luckily, the chief teller made a list of the serial numbers. Come on, Marion. Well, goodbye, Lime. By the way, where are you planning to be? We may need you for the trial.
Well, you can always look for me, old man. There's no law against that. Tell you what, I'll give you a little hint. The Elephant maybe hasn't signed that oil contract. He may need a little advice after all, so you'll probably find him in Becurata for a while. There's a fortune teller I want to look up. I owe him some money. So long, Marion. Goodbye, old man. May your beard never grow white. May your shadow never grow less.
And now, Harry Lime.
Well, friends, it was a short marriage, but a very pleasant one. If you should settle down somewhere and start enjoying easy living, rich food, and fine liquor, don't worry about what it'll do to your figure. Just about the fat it tends to develop between the ears.
The Lives of Harry Lime, September 14th, 1951, Love Affair, Orson Welles starring in, the prequel to the movie The Third Man. Hope you enjoyed that. Did you like it, Lisa?
I liked
the
it.
Music, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's very catchy. I mean,
right?
Of course, not as catchy as Dragnet, but, you know,
no,
it's good.
That's a zither. It's a zither.
Zither.
Yeah, played by Anton Karas. Very cool series, Orson Welles. All right, let's take a quick break. Then it's more on the WGN Radio Theater. Nostalgia Digest, very cool. I like the Nostalgia Digest a lot. Hey, you know what, Lisa? Well, have you seen any movies lately?
Movies?
Yeah.
I have, actually.
What'd you see?
This week I saw Bombshell with my daughter.
How was that?
You know, it was good, not amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it. I didn't love it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it has a great
Charlize Theron.
Charlize Theron.
She plays, don't tell me, she plays, oh gosh, like a news girl from Fox News, right?
Yeah, they're all news girls. There's Charlize Theron plays Megyn Kelly.
Okay, Megyn Kelly. And she looks just like her and sounds just like
it's
her.
It's really amazing how all of these actresses looked so much like the actual person. We had Margot Robbie, who played I think it was.
She's not hard on the eyes.
No, she's not. But she played actually somebody who's fictitious, not an actual person, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Nicole Kidman. She was fantastic as well.
What did she play?
She played, I don't remember the name of the person, honestly. Mm-hmm. There was John Lithgow who was in it. He's really great.
He's such a great actor.
So good. So it was interesting. I mean, do you know the plot of the movie?
Well, I kind of do. It's having to do with like a sort of a scandal that happened at Fox.
Yeah. I mean, it's based on that data. You know, it's all about sexual harassment and how it was handled and dealt with. And John Lithgow, man, I mean, I believed everything that came out of his mouth. He sat there and, you know, he was the one who wanted to see the girls, you know, lift up their dresses.
Oh, really?
Oh,
so he was the guy.
Yeah, and twirl around for me. That was his thing.
Oh,
give me a twirl, he'd say.
Yeah. So there was a guy at Fox News that was like that?
Well, that's what the movie says. I mean, I don't know how much of it is
actually say twirl around?
Well, that's what he did in the movie. Fox News. But
no way.
Yeah, interesting. Have you seen anything lately?
What did I
see? No movies?
Yeah, I took my son to see the latest Star Wars movie, and he did not like that movie at all.
What was the title?
I don't know. The latest one, whichever one is out right now. You want to hear something crazy, though?
What?
I have never seen a Star Wars movie.
You know, I'm not a big Star Wars freak or anything. I've seen some, but so many years ago, and I'm not really.
But why wouldn't I? I mean, you know, I like sci-fi.
I know you do.
I mean, I'm not.
I think you have to start from the beginning.
I mean,
you know?
Sci-fi is not like my favorite genre.
Although, you know what? I'm not a huge sci-fi fan, but you know what I really like?
Black Mirror.
Well, I like Black Mirror, but I was talking about Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And I went on my on-demand recently, and I started watching the Twilight Zones from the beginning.
Really?
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, I watched maybe the first three or four episodes, and I'm sort of back into it again. I remember sitting and watching them as a kid, right before I'd go to bed. I had a little black and white television.
That's why you're a little out there.
I had a black and white television in my room, and I used to watch the Twilight Zone.
Rod Serling, he had some.
Yep.
The great thing, you know, and the reason why I wanted to turn the Twilight Zone into a radio series, I mean, you know, it came. So the year that I started doing it was 2002. I had sold my company, right? I had sold a company in 1998, worked for the new owners. That was a mistake. I didn't like that at all.
I don't think it'd be good working for anyone.
I started a company in my parents' basement, right? And then I sold it in 1998 to a public company. And I was like wanting to do something different. And I thought, you know what? I'll do a new time radio show, right?
Right.
Because I was dealing with all the classic radio shows. And growing up, I loved The Twilight Zone.
Yep.
Loved watching it. And I always felt that that series could be done better on radio because it was such an imaginative series. Yep. But you got makeup. The makeup was bad, and the, you know, the costumes were bad. When there would be like
the
monsters,
the production qualities were you know, just really antiquated.
They really were, and you know, they just didn't have the special effects you needed for that. I mean, you're talking about the greatest sci-fi writers of the era.
Right.
Rod Serling was not per se a sci-fi writer, but he did write a lot of those stories. But he had a lot, you know, George Clayton Johnson and all these different amazing writers, and Ray Bradbury even wrote one, and it just wouldn't work. It doesn't, to me, watching it is not as good as the theater of the mind.
Right.
Even though
it's
great.
Right,
I mean, Twilight Zone's great. Don't get me wrong. I love the Twilight Zone TV show.
I enjoy it.
Yep. But I think when you listen to the radio shows, and of course I'm biased because I produced it, but when you listen to the shows, you can see those monsters and you can see the
And they're that much more vivid in
alien
your mind.
Worlds and things. And we had so many great actors on there.
Yep.
I mean, when I think back of all of the actors that I had on that series, I mean, Luke Perry, who passed away last year, I was so saddened by that because he did a lot of those for me. And then, you know, Lou Diamond Phillips, we had Michael York, I had Lou Gossett Jr., Jason Alexander did a bunch of them. He used to, it's funny, I used to call up Jason and I'd say, hey, I got a couple of scripts for you. And he'd say, is that all you have is two? Don't you have more? He loved doing them.
Yeah, he's one of the people that I long to meet.
Yeah, Don Johnson did some for me. Ernie Hudson. Jane Seymour did some. Jim Caviezel did some. Man, I'll tell you, we had a really great lineup of people. Sean Astin,
yeah.
Malcolm McDowell.
You had a great product, and it was a great process.
It was. It was fun to do.
From beginning to end, it was a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. I had a studio in Schaumburg. And they would fly in, you know, to the Schaumburg airport there.
Really?
Yeah, a lot of them would. And they'd fly into the Schaumburg airport and we'd
that
pick them up.
That executive airport?
Yeah.
Isn't it like Palatine or something?
No.
Palwaukee?
There was a, no, was it was a little.
Schaumburg?
No, Schaumburg airport.
I didn't know there was.
It was right
one.
Down the block from.
Oh my gosh.
From my office. Yeah. And they would fly in there on a private jet a lot of the times. And then we'd, you know, cater it. And come there and do the shows. It was a blast.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. And then Stacy Keach was the host.
Right.
Remember when you picked him up at the airport?
I picked him up at the airport.
It was funny, Lisa. So he was very he was very diligent about where to pick him up. He didn't want to be picked up at the where you normally would be picked
right.
up.
Right, he did it upstairs,
not at
the baggage. At
O'Hare is downstairs. You pick people up,
but that wasn't the problem.
He wanted to be picked up at
I was
departures,
upstairs.
And you.
No, that wasn't the problem.
What was the problem?
The problem, if you want to be clear,
what was
the problem? Is that you had originally asked somebody else to pick him up.
Oh, is that what it was?
And that someone else, you just didn't work out.
It didn't work out.
No, and then you asked me to do it, so yeah. I did it, but you didn't tell Stacy Keach that it was somebody else, so he was still trying to call that someone else instead of me.
Poor Stacy.
And so he was calling somebody who wasn't answering, and I was waiting there for him.
Yeah.
And so it's pretty much all your fault.
Let me tell you something. Stacy is the nicest guy in the world.
Well, he
too.
Wasn't very happy
he wasn't
when he
happy
got in
that
my car.
Day. No, he wasn't happy that
no,
day.
No, but we calmed down and we ultimately had dinner together.
Yeah.
Remember we all
yes,
went out for
I
dinner
did.
One
that was
night.
Great. Yeah, yep. That was great. Those were the days.
Those were.
But I'm going to do a new series.
Yeah.
I'm doing
working
a new.
On it.
I'm working on a new series. And it's going to be really good.
We got high hopes
for you,
Carl.
It's going to be really scary, Lisa.
Yeah.
Scary.
Scary is great.
You know, Twilight Zone was not necessarily scary.
Kind of creepy.
It was creepy and more Twilight Zone-y, sci-fi-y. But this new series that I'm going to do, oh boy, wait.
Okay.
You want to be in it?
I do.
Lisa wants to act in it.
Sure, I do.
You know, we're going to be acting on the cruise, too. We're going to do this
yes.
cruise, and we're going to be...
We're going to Bermuda August 1st of this year.
And we're going to do some reenactments
there. We're going to have you guys join us. This is not only a cruise to enjoy Bermuda and to enjoy the luxury life of a luxury cruise liner, but it's a classic radio cruise.
Yeah.
So I can't think of anything better to marry all those things.
Come to Bermuda with us.
Carl's going to be my cabana boy.
Yep.
We're going to have Mai Tais.
August 1st.
And we're
going to
have
nights.
A lot of fun.
7 nights.
You can call our travel agency, Keen Luxury Travel, for more information. Their number is 800-856-1155.
Right, or go to WGNRadioTheater.com. Scroll down, and there is a banner. You click it, and it gives you all the information.
We hope you'll join us in Bermuda.
Make sure you come with us, folks.
Oh, we're so excited.
It's going to be 85 degrees. It's going to be a lot of fun. Lisa's going to be barking orders at me. Go get me a pina colada.
That's right.
And, you know, get me this, get
and
me that.
You're going to say how many
and
do
I'll
you
be,
want.
I'll be like, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Whatever you say.
In my dreams.
In our next hour, Father Knows Best. Hour 4 of the WGN Radio Theater. Speaking of movies, Lisa, did you watch the movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
You
didn't see that?
Nope.
But your husband saw that, right? Dan saw it, right?
I don't recall.
Like it?
I don't remember.
You said he didn't like it. I wasn't sure if you saw it.
I didn't see it.
So, to me, that was one of the best movies of 2019.
Well, you're not alone. A lot of people feel that
way. I thought that was so great. And I watched The Irishman on Netflix, and it was okay. I thought it was a little bit kind of boring. Just a little bit boring. And I like Martin Scorsese.
Yeah, of course.
One of my favorite directors. The movie for me of 2019 was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood or whatever.
I cannot comment.
You know, Quentin Tarantino, Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio.
I know about the movie.
Great movie.
Yeah.
The movie I'm dying to go see, I'm going to go see it maybe this week. No, is 1917.
Oh, 1917. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just saw that. I just watched
Spielberg.
The trailer for that.
Oh, I can't wait
it's
to watch that.
It's at the theater right
near
me.
Yeah, that looks really, really good. All right, in this hour, Father Knows Best. Good comedy. Robert Young starring. And he was the only guy that made the transition.
Yeah. Isn't that show also on Antenna TV? Father Knows Best.
Sure,
on it.
Father Knows Best.
I think they
best.
Had a marathon, a Father Knows Best marathon recently.
Most of the shows that we air on WGN Radio Theater made the transition to television, like Gunsmoke in our next hour. And you can watch the counterparts on Antenna TV. So this hour, Father Knows Best, Robert Young. Before that, though, we will play or listen to our segment, which is called Just the Facts.
Just the Facts.
And that's coming your way after these words.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you're about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect
the innocent. It's true when you have the right statistics.
That's true. And when I don't, then it's not true.
Yeah.
So we're going
to
do...
Well,
we're
just to clarify.
Just to clarify.
So, so Jolton Joe DiMaggio did strike out 36 times
in 1951. And my facts were incorrect.
That's okay.
I stand corrected.
You know what?
And now we've got the
Let's
facts.
Let's see. Finally, 2020. It took you... How many years?
Four and a half.
55 years.
Well, here's the thing, though.
To finally be wrong.
I found the statistic where I found it, and I showed it to you, and it was
matter.
Wrong.
You
well,
wrong.
It does matter.
But you were wrong.
No, the research was wrong. But
you know what, Lisa?
What, Carl?
You give it your all, and that's all that matters.
That's for certain.
You give it 110%.
That is true.
Even when you're wrong, you give
I'm
it 110%.
Right. Even when I'm wrong, I'm still right.
That's right.
So we're going to play a little
that's
Just
wrong,
the Facts.
But you're right.
We're going to talk about some fun facts, trivia, and history for the year 1950, which is the Father Knows Best show that we are just about to hear. So, 1950, Sunset...
Are these all correct?
These are correct, because even when I'm wrong, I'm right.
Okay.
Sunset Boulevard was a 1950
Gloria
film
Swanson.
Directed by Billy Wilder, and of course,
William Holden.
And William Holden, Gloria Swanson played Norma Desmond.
Yes. I'll have my close-up, please.
You see, this is my life. It always will be. There's nothing else.
Mr. DeMille.
Just us. And the cameras.
And those wonderful people out there in the dark.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
And there you have it.
Yeah, that's,
one
know,
of the most
good,
famous lines.
Really good movie, too. Have you ever seen it? Have you ever watched the movie? It's really quite a film noir.
I've actually seen parts of it, but what I have seen is the show multiple times on stage.
Oh, have you?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes.
The movie is really, really good. I mean, it's what's so... I think it might have been the first time other than... I think later they did the movie DOA, you know, Dead on Arrival, and they did sort of the same premise where the guy is dead telling the story, what happened to him.
Right.
You know, same thing with DOA, but... that was pretty new to do something like that in 1950.
Yeah. Well, this is still a current show that I've seen. Broadway in Chicago did it. Drury Lane did it. So this is a show that is still quite popular today. So it's really persisted through time.
1950. Huh?
1950. Still in 1950, on February 15th, Walt Disney released Cinderella. That's the original Cinderella. And the love song duet from the 1950 version of Cinderella.
So this is the miracle that I've been dreaming of.
Even the music has a different feel to it. It's very romantic, Carl.
Put me right to sleep.
You could use a little
romance
in your life.
Puts me to sleep. Anything about romance puts me to sleep. Like, I guess I'm just not a romantic person.
Well, isn't it funny that Cinderella has, again, persisted through time? It started in 1950, and children born today are still watching, obviously, the updated versions of Cinderella. It's a love story.
Yeah.
I know you're not familiar with love stories, but I'll teach you. And the most popular toys in 1950 were Woolly Willy.
What's a Willy Willy?
A Woolly Willy.
Woolly Willy?
Do you remember that?
It's
that board that has a little magnetic thing, and you move the little magnet pieces around to make a space.
I have no idea.
You don't know what Woolly Willy is?
No.
All right, I'll show you. I'll pull it up
online.
No
idea what it is.
You know these two. The Magic 8-Ball.
I know what Boole Boole
There you go.
Same
thing.
I don't know what a Willy Willy is.
Yeah, it's the same. I'll show it to you. There's the Magic 8-Ball.
Magic 8-Ball. So, like, you shake it
you
and turn it around and it says you
ask it a question.
It would always say to me, you are a dingleberry.
No, there was no dingleberry on the Magic 8-Ball.
You are dorky.
You clearly never had a Magic 8-Ball.
You need to get out more.
Nope, none of those
That's
were on there.
That's what it would say to me.
It would be like, try again next time or something.
Try to make friends.
Nope, you never had a Magic 8-Ball. You had a stilted childhood. And the third one is Silly Putty.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I loved Silly Putty.
You know what? I just realized all of these toys, all three of them are toys that you could go out and buy today.
Yeah.
All of them.
Do you remember when you would take Silly Putty and then you would take the comics? You know, like, you know, you get the comics and you would put
like
it on there.
Like a Dennis the Menace kind of thing.
And you'd put the Silly Putty on the on
and
the
it,
color
comics.
It comes
comics. Right
it
off on
there.
And
it would be on the Silly Putty.
Yep, I know.
And then you
That's
would just,
thing.
Then you'd twist
Smush
it and
it
all
off
that.
Together.
Yeah.
And then you put it back in the little egg.
Yeah, and I used to feel like I was getting ripped off because there wasn't very much Silly Putty in this big egg.
It was very small.
They'd give you in like this big egg. You'd be like, oh, wow, this whole egg's got Silly Putty in it. You open it up, and it's just got a little bit
honestly,
of Silly Putty in
I think you were ripped off because you didn't have a Wooly Willy.
What's that? I don't know what a Wooly Willy
I'll
is.
I'll show you.
All right. Well, okay. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks, Carl.
That segment brought to you by Cat's Pride. And it's time now for Father Knows Best, situation comedy series. And, of course, we all remember it as a television series. It airs on Tenet TV a lot. Started on radio in 1949. The whole series was set in the Midwest. Robert Young played General Insurance Agent Jim Anderson. That's a good trivia question right there. Like, what was his profession?
Yeah.
He was an insurance agent.
Yep.
Many people might think, oh, maybe he was a doctor. No, that was Marcus Welby, MD. That was later. His wife, Margaret, his daughters were Betty and Kathy. His son was Bud. And it was a situation comedy series. And it lasted on radio until 1954. That was the same year it moved to television. Robert Young was the only cast member that made the transition. Everybody else was booted. They gave them all a pink slip.
Yep.
They came out of the radio studio. They're thinking, hey, we're going to get on TV. And they were like, you're gone. So there you have it. We have a radio broadcast for you now called Superstitious Folk. They're all kind of have superstitions in the family. Robert Young starring from May 25th, 1950, uninterrupted. Here is Father Knows Best.
Mother, is Maxwell House really the only coffee in the world?
Well, your father says so, and your father knows best.
Yes, it's Father Knows Best, transcribed in Hollywood, starring Robert Young as father. A half-hour visit with your neighbors, the Andersons. Brought to you by America's favorite coffee, Maxwell House. The coffee that's always good to the last drop. Since the dark beginnings of time, superstition has played a dismal part in the fumbling progress of man. We, however, live in an enlightened age, and thank goodness, we've thrown off the yoke of ignorant superstition. Well, I mean, knocking on wood isn't really a superstition. You do it just because, well, anyway, in Springfield, in the white frame house on Maple Street, we find Jim Anderson packing for a trip to Chicago. And for a change, everything is peaceful and quiet, like this.
Jim, it certainly won't hurt to take him along.
Margaret, I'm only going to be gone 3 days. How many pairs of socks do you think I can wear?
Well, you never can tell, dear, and it's best to be on the safe side.
12 pairs of socks. Anybody think I was going to Alaska for the entire winter?
Jim, they weigh practically nothing, and I certainly
think... All right, put them in. I'll have enough socks for everybody at the whole convention.
Dad!
We're upstairs, bud.
Jim, you don't need all those shirts.
What do you mean, all those shirts? I'm only taking 6.
But you'll only be away 3 days. You said so yourself.
But, honey, I've got to look neat. All the big shots from the home office will be there.
I think 3 shirts are quite enough. You just have to be a little careful, that's all.
Okay, 3 shirts. Fine thing, a man can't even pack the bag the way he wants to.
Say, Dad, can I talk to you for a minute?
About what?
Well...
Handkerchiefs. Mustn't forget handkerchiefs.
I've already put them in, dear.
Oh, thank you. Well, what is it, bud?
Could I have $3?
No. What, happened to that bottle opener I had in the top drawer?
Jim, if it's going to be that kind of convention...
It isn't, Margaret, but I just thought... Well, never mind.
Dad.
But I said no.
I know, Dad, but this is an emergency.
What kind of an emergency?
The worst kind.
I've never known you to have any other. Why do you need $3?
Well, it's for the baseball team. I need another bat.
You mean you've broken the old one already?
No, but... Well, I think I've used up all the hits.
You what?
I'm in an awful slump, Dad. I haven't had a hit in 2 weeks. And if I can just buy a bat with some hits in it...
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. You've got a perfectly good bat. Why waste $3 on another one?
But, Dad, I've got to do something to change my luck.
Luck? Superstitious twaddle. If you can't get a hit with the old bat, you won't get one with the new one either.
But, Dad...
Particularly if I have to pay for it. Well, I guess I'm all packed.
You haven't forgotten anything, have you, dear?
I don't think so. But how about taking the bag downstairs like a good fellow?
Okay, but look, Dad, we're playing a very important game this
Mother!
Afternoon.
Mother!
And
just a moment, Bud. What is it, Kathy?
I don't care what she says, you can't go.
Mother, Betty says I can't go to the club with her this afternoon, and you said I could.
I said I'd ask her, dear.
Mother, it's bad enough going out with a boy I don't even know. But if I have to drag her along...
They're going to play tennis, and I want to watch.
Kathy, if Betty says you can't go, then you can't go. Now stop arguing.
You love her more than you love me. That's why you're always sticking up for her.
I'm not sticking up for anybody. You can watch Bud play baseball.
No!
What?
Holy cow, Dad. You don't know what you're doing.
Oh, I don't, huh?
She's worse than a black cat. She's worse than an umpire.
Now, listen, Bud. There's no reason...
But, Dad, you've never heard her. She sounds like a fire siren. She gets both teams rattled.
Bunch of sandlotters.
It's all right, Kathy. You can stay home with me this afternoon.
But I want to do something.
We'll find something to do.
How about the bag, Bud?
Okay. Not having enough trouble. They want me to take her along.
Father.
What is it, Betty?
Is Mr. Davis's nephew tall and dark?
How do I know? I've never even seen him. What difference does it make anyway?
Well, Janie Liggett told my fortune yesterday, and the card said to be careful of a tall, dark man. And if he's tall and dark...
Betty... If he's 8 feet tall and has hair made of licorice, you're still going out with him. He's only going to be in town this weekend, and I gave Ed Davis my word.
But, Father...
Most idiotic thing I've ever heard in my life. Just because Janie Liggett hasn't got a brain in her head...
It wasn't Janie's idea, Father. She has a fortune-telling set, and it's wonderful. It costs $4.
Oh, pardon me. I thought it was one of the cheap $2 sets.
Jim, I... No, you're going to say it's silly, but I did have a dream about a wedding last night.
Margaret, not you, too.
Well, you remember my grandmother Williams.
The Hottentot kid.
Jim, Grandmother Williams was a very sweet woman. And she said when you dream of a wedding, it means trouble.
Well, that depends on who's getting married.
Jim.
Margaret, you certainly don't believe in that poppycock, do you?
Well... No, but if Betty's going to feel uneasy...
Feel uneasy about what? Since when is a dream something to be afraid of?
I'm not afraid of dreams, Daddy.
9 years old, and she's the only intelligent one in the whole house. You're a very sensible little girl, Kathy.
I'm not afraid of anything. Because I've got a lucky penny, and a rabbit's foot, and a horseshoe, and...
Margaret, what's gotten into this family, anyway? These aren't the Middle Ages. This is the 20th century. We're supposed to be intelligent human beings.
Jim, it's not that we believe in these things.
Then what does it mean? All this twaddle about dreams and fortune tellers and bats with hits in them? You sound like a bunch of Stone Age simpletons.
Why, Father!
Now, just a moment, Jim Anderson. You have just as many silly little superstitions as anyone else.
I certainly do not.
You most certainly do.
Kathy...
Yes, Daddy?
Go downstairs and help Bud.
What's he doing?
How do I know what he's doing? Go downstairs and find out. And help him.
Gee whiz.
Now, see here, Margaret.
Yes?
In my time, I've walked under hundreds of ladders, broken thousands of mirrors, ignored millions of black cats. And if you can call that being superstitious...
I'll bet that's Charlie.
Who?
Charlie Davis. And, Father, if he's tall and dark...
Betty.
But, Father, Janie said...
I don't care what Janie said. You are going out with Charlie Davis.
Oh, poo.
Betty, it's for you.
She'll be right down, bud. Go ahead, Betty.
If this is the 20th century, why do I have to be treated like somebody's slave?
I don't know what's gotten into that girl.
What are you looking for, dear?
My gray hat. It was right up here on the shelf.
It's downstairs in the hall closet.
Yeah, I mean my old gray hat, the one I always wear to conventions.
Jim, it was all worn out. It was dirty and the ribbon was faded.
Margaret, what did you do with my hat?
Well, I gave it to Mr. Adams.
Mr. You mean the junk man?
Yes, dear.
You gave my hat to the junk man?
Jim, you have a brand new hat.
Margaret, how could you do a thing like that to me? That was my luck. I mean, how could you?
But you said...
I've worn that hat to conventions for 15 years. You know I never go to a convention without it. What were you thinking of?
Father, he is tall, and he's got the blackest hair you ever saw. I won't go with him, and you can't make me.
Oh, I can't I? Betty Anderson, you'll go out with that boy, or you'll never go out again.
But, Father...
You're not having enough trouble. Give a man's hat away at a time like this.
Betty, after all, your father knows best, and if he thinks...
All right, I'll go. But if anything happens to me, you'll have no one to blame but yourself.
Betty, your father's going away. Aren't you going to say goodbye?
Sure, goodbye. And I hope you have a very nice time.
Most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. A perfectly good hat sitting up on a shelf, not hurting a soul.
Jim, you said you weren't superstitious.
Superstitious? What has superstition got to do with it? I like that hat. It was the best hat I've ever had.
But it was all worn out.
It was a perfect hat for going to conventions, and you know it. Bud!
Jim.
You want me, Dad?
Get Mr. Adams on the phone.
Who?
Mr. Adams.
The junk man?
Tell him I want my gray hat back.
It's in the closet, Dad.
My old gray hat. Tell him I'll give him $5 for it.
For that hat?
Bud.
Okay, Dad.
Jim, you're being very foolish about this whole thing.
Oh, I am I? Just because I have a lucky... just because I happen to like a certain hat, I'm being foolish. That's fine.
Jim, your train leaves in less than an hour.
Well, let it leave. I'll take a plane. I'll walk. But until Mr. Adams comes back with my hat,
Daddy!
I'm not going to... What is it, Kathy?
Mr. Davis is here.
Oh, no. What does he want? I'll be right down, Ed.
Take your time, Jim. No hurry.
Jim, please don't make a fuss in front of Ed.
Of course not. You know I've got better sense than that.
I do.
Well, I guess I've got everything except my hat.
I don't understand, Jim, after that long speech you made about dreams and fortune tellers.
Margaret, my hat has nothing to do with dreams and fortune tellers. It isn't a question of superstition or anything like that. I merely want my hat. And in the future, will you please leave my things alone?
Yes, dear.
I'm not asking for anything unusual. Just don't give my hats to the junk man.
All right, dear.
Jim, I'm sorry to barge in at a time like this. I know you must be kind of busy.
Well, it's all right.
How are you, Ed?
Fine, Margaret, just fine. Jim, I have some property in Chicago, and I wonder if you'll do me a big favor while you're there.
Sure, Ed, I'll be glad to.
Dad, Mr. Adams wasn't there.
That's impossible. He must be there.
Okay, but Mrs. Adams said he wasn't. She's going to see if she can find him.
Margaret, now do you see what you've done?
Jim, you said...
I know what I said, but good grief.
Anything wrong, Jim?
Everything's wrong. We've had nothing but trouble all day. My good hat's gone, the junk man's gone. Betty didn't even want to go out with your nephew just because he's tall and dark.
You mean Charlie?
Have you ever heard anything so ridiculous?
Oh, I don't understand.
Oh, Janie Liggett has some kind of an idiotic set that tells fortunes, and she told Betty...
Oh, I understand that part, all right. Used to be quite a hand with a Ouija board. But I don't understand about Charlie.
Well, there's nothing to worry about, Ed. She went with him, even though he is tall and dark.
But he isn't. Charlie's short, and he has red hair.
Oh, no.
Thank you.
Double, double, toil and trouble. Fire, burn, and cauldron bubble. It's a far cry from the witches of Macbeth to the Andersons of Springfield, but not as far as you might think. An hour has passed, and the situation has altered only slightly. Bud is out playing baseball. Kathy is out playing, well, whatever it is that nine-year-old girls play. But in the white frame house on Maple Street, the air is charged with nervous tension. Not a word has been heard from Betty, and the Andersons and Ed Davis can do nothing but wait. Like this.
Don't like this. Don't like it at all.
Look, Ed, I don't care what you do, but do something.
Well, let's try this. Let me see now.
Jim, I don't understand how you can sit there at a time like this and play canasta.
Well, what do you want me to do? Margaret, we haven't left a stone unturned. We've called all her friends, the club, all the authorities, and they've promised to let us know the second either one of them turns up.
There must be someone else we can call.
Like who? I'm not even sure calling the police was such a good idea. Jim, you've got to understand my position. After all, Charlie's my nephew, and we don't know where he is. The idiot. We don't know where Betty is, or how the boy with the dark hair got into it. It's very confusing. Whose turn is it?
Well, the whole thing is certainly nothing to worry about. Just because Janie Liggett is a superstitious little twerp...
Jim, after all the fuss you made about your hat, how can you call anyone superstitious?
My hat has nothing to do with it. And I didn't make a fuss.
Then why did you miss your train?
Because I decided to fly. I wanted to find out what happened to Betty. That's all. Nothing complicated about it. And it has nothing to do with superstition. I guarantee that when Betty shows up, there'll be a perfectly logical explanation of the whole thing.
Well, I hope you're right.
Of course I'm right. Go ahead, Ed. It's your turn. You haven't put down a card. Oh. Well, just a minute. It's certainly taking long enough. I have a right to think about it, don't I? Just don't rush me. You know, when I was a boy, we lived in an old house on the north side, and the place was simply crawling with ghosts. Well, one day...
Wait a minute, Ed. Don't tell me you believe in ghosts.
Why not?
Well, it's ridiculous. Everybody knows there's no such thing.
Oh, they do, do they? Well, let me tell you, Jim, there wasn't a night went by...
Betty?
It's me, Mom.
I'm sorry, Ed. What are you doing home, bud? Thought you were going to play baseball.
Well, I started to play, but... Gosh, Dad, I told you that bat wasn't any good.
Bud, what on earth happened to your eye?
Ye gods, another shiner. Bud, have you been fighting again?
I got hit with a baseball.
That's great. You know, if this keeps up, you're going to have that eye worn out.
I couldn't help it, Dad. I asked you to let me buy another bat.
You were hit with a ball. What does a bat have to do with it?
Well, they took me out for a pinch hitter. And while I was sitting on the bench, I got hit in the eye.
There, you see. That's what you get for being superstitious.
Why aren't you on the train?
Who said anything about a train?
Jim, Bud is only doing the things you taught him.
I taught him? When did I teach him anything about a bat with no hits in it?
Well, it amounts to the same thing. Just because you're concerned over a silly old hat.
I'm not concerned about my hat. The hat has nothing to do with it. And Margaret, will you please stop changing the subject? Oh, no, not again.
What was that?
The glazier's delight. Kathy!
Bud, tell Kathy to come in here, please.
Okay. Tells me I can't get a new bat and then blames the whole thing on me.
As I was saying, Jim, we had a rocking chair in our living room. And every night it went back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Well, what does that prove?
Well, it certainly wasn't moving all by itself.
You know, Ed, you certainly have some very peculiar ideas.
I don't see anything peculiar about them at all. And if you weren't so doggone stubborn...
Stubborn? Me? You're the one who's being stubborn. I'll show you a dozen books that prove there's no such thing as a ghost.
And I'll show you two dozen books that prove there are.
Jim, my grandmother Williams said that when she was a girl...
Now, there's a great authority for you. A dame who spent half her life running around with Hottentots.
She was a very sweet woman, and you have no right to make fun of her.
I'm not making fun of her. I'm merely trying to tell you that superstition is silly.
Where did you get that hat?
What?
Oh, nothing. I was just thinking.
Come on, will ya?
Well, stop pulling me. Why do you always have to pull me?
Kathy, what did you do out there?
I couldn't help it, Daddy. I was trying to make everybody lucky.
She heaved a horseshoe through the garage window.
Oh, fine. We just had it fixed.
But, Daddy, I was worried about Betty, and they told me if I threw it over my right shoulder...
Your left shoulder, Dopey.
Oh, well, no wonder.
Kathy, do you see what you've done?
She was just trying to be helpful, dear.
Sure, and I'm going to be set back another $4.20 for a window.
But, Daddy, they said it was lucky.
Who said it was lucky?
The man who fixed the window.
Look, Kathy, let's examine this thing calmly and with simple logic. Why is a horseshoe lucky?
Well, everybody says it is.
Horses have millions of them, and are they lucky?
Some of them are.
That idiotic rabbit's foot you carry around. Where's the rabbit it used to belong to? Did it bring him any luck?
Well, he was lucky while he had it.
But it didn't keep him from getting shot, did it? He had 4 feet, four nice, lucky rabbit's feet, and he still got shot.
He must have looked at the moon over the wrong shoulder.
Now, look, Kathy.
Jim.
I'll answer it.
Dear, if it's Betty, please don't lose your temper.
Oh, silliest family I've ever seen. I think we were living in the Middle Ages. Horseshoes and rabbit's feet.
Father, how could you do this to me? How could you?
You get inside. I'll talk to you later. Officer?
We found her at Crandall's drugstore, Mr. Anderson. She was having a soda.
And he wouldn't even let me finish.
Oh, well, sorry you were put to all this trouble, officer. I'll see that it doesn't happen again.
That's okay. We're used to it.
Jim, is it Betty?
Mother, why did you do this to me? Having me dragged home by the police and everybody looking at me.
Darling, we were so worried.
Where's Charlie? What did you do with that rattle-brained redhead?
Did you want the boys? Nobody told me to bring them.
You mean there were two of them?
Father, why didn't you listen to me? I told you I didn't want to go with Tommy.
You said it was Charlie.
I didn't say it was Charlie. I said he was tall and dark, and Janie Liggett said I was going to have trouble. But you wouldn't listen.
I'm sorry I listened in the first place. Who was the other boy?
Tommy.
Tommy who?
I don't know, but he's a friend of Charlie's, and Charlie was trying to get a date for him. And he knew he was going to be late, so he sent Tommy, and we met him down at Mr. Crandall's. And it's all your fault.
What's my fault? If you hadn't started that ridiculous thing about Janie Liggett and the tall, dark man...
Will you be needing me for anything else?
Hmm? Oh, thank you, officer. I think everything's under control now.
Well, I wouldn't be so sure. Sounds to me like the whole house is infested with leprechauns. Better leave a bowl of milk out for them tonight. Otherwise, you'll have nothing but trouble.
Thank you, officer. We'll do just that. Now we've got leprechauns. Betty... What happened to that idiot nephew of mine?
Nothing. When the policeman came, he and Tommy didn't know what to do. So, they're having another soda.
Just wait till I get my hands on that carrot-headed numbskull. Just wait.
It wasn't his fault, Ed. The whole thing was a very unfortunate misunderstanding, that's all.
It's more than that. It's a perfect example of what I've been trying to tell you. You see what superstition has done to this family?
Jim, it's not that important.
It is important. We're supposed to be a healthy, normal American family. And what happened to us? We become involved in a bunch of old-world superstitions, and all our lives are affected. Bud gets a black eye, Kathy breaks a window, Betty gets the whole neighborhood upset with her tall, dark stranger. Jim, it's very well to scoff at superstition, but when I was a boy...
Ye gods, now what?
I tell you, that chair rocked back and forth. Back and forth.
Mr. Anderson, my friend, my wonderful friend.
It's about time you got here. Where's my hat?
Jim, you mustn't blame Mr. Adams. I gave him the hat.
Mrs. Anderson, look what I brought for you. The biggest box of candy I could find. This is the biggest box of candy in Springfield.
Why, Mr. Adams.
Go ahead, take it, take it. I want you to have it. It's for you.
Mr. Adams, all we want is the hat. May I please have...
See, I brought a doll for the little girl. Presents for everybody. A baseball bat and perfume.
Mr. Adams, I have to go to Chicago. May I please have my hat?
Look, Mr. Anderson, cigars. The biggest box I could find.
Mr. Adams.
3 for a half. That's expensive. But nothing is too good for my friend.
Thank you very much. Now may I have my hat?
The hat. That wonderful hat. You know, all my life I've been an unlucky man. A junk man. A poor peddler. And then... You gave me that hat, that beautiful hat.
I said I'd give you $5.
Oh, I couldn't sell the hat.
Not that hat.
$10.
Jim.
Mr. Anderson.
$15.
I wouldn't sell it for $1,000,000. Haven't you heard what it did for me? I just won the Irish sweepstakes.
It doesn't take long for 3 days to come and go. Just about 3 days. And that's precisely what's happened in Springfield. Jim Anderson has gone to Chicago and come back again. And now, for the first time in 3 days, he's at the breakfast table with his family. Like this.
I guess I made them sit up and take notice. Right in front of everybody, Mr. Craig said they couldn't have placed the Springfield area in more capable hands.
Jim, he didn't.
He certainly did. He's only the president of the company, that's all. Boy, you should have seen the eyes pop.
Say, Dad, you know how many hits I got yesterday with the bat Mr. Adams gave me? 6.
That's fine, bud. How come you had a game yesterday?
Well, it wasn't a regular league game. I was just fooling around with Kathy's team.
He hit 3 home runs.
Oh, it wasn't so much.
Father?
Yes, Benny?
I'm going to a formal next Friday, and I saw the most beautiful dress.
Again?
Betty, your father just got home.
But, Mother, Tommy said it was going to be the most exclusive formal of the year.
Tommy? You mean the tall, dark one?
Uh-huh.
You know, maybe we're going to have trouble with him after all.
Jim, let's not get started on that again. It was a very successful convention, wasn't it?
It certainly was. I accomplished a great deal.
And you did it all without your lucky hat, didn't you?
Margaret, I never said it was a lucky hat. I merely said, well, a man's entitled to a few little idiosyncrasies. That's all it was, so let's just forget it.
All right, dear.
Daddy?
Yes, Kathy?
Is everything all right now? I mean, you aren't going away on any more trips or anything, are you?
No, Kathy, I'm staying right here, and everything's just as fine as it can be.
Good. Now, can I please have my rabbit's foot back?
Did you know, now there's an instant coffee with roaster fresh, pure coffee flavor? It's Instant Maxwell House, the instant coffee with a famous flavor, the happiest combination in coffee. Wonderful, good to the last drop flavor, combined with the convenience and thrift of coffee made instantly in the cup. Unlike most instant coffees, it's all rich, pure coffee, nothing added. Tomorrow, try the instant coffee with a famous flavor, Instant Maxwell House, instantly good to the last drop. Join us again next week when we'll be back with Father Knows Best, starring Robert Young as Jim Anderson, with Roy Bargy and the Maxwell House Orchestra, and yours truly, Bill Foreman. Don't forget, membership cards for the Robert Young Good Drivers Club are waiting for you at your local NBC station. Get a man-to-man or dad-to-daughter pledge and sign up today. Be a good driver. Get your membership card in the Robert Young Good Drivers Club today. Now until next Thursday, good night and good luck from the makers of Maxwell House, America's favorite brand of coffee. Always good to the last drop. Father Knows Best was transcribed in Hollywood and written by Ed James. Now stay tuned for Screen Guild Theater, which follows immediately over most of these stations.
Stay tuned for Screen Guild and The Seventh Veil on NBC.
Maxwell House.
It's good to the last drop.
It's always good to the last drop. Those, you know, they've been using that slogan forever.
Yeah.
They've never changed the slogan. Some products change the slogan.
They not did not.
Not Maxwell House.
No, I remember it too.
And it's interesting because didn't Robert Young also do commercials for Maxwell House for years?
He did.
And then was he? Yeah, he did.
He did.
Because it was Joe DiMaggio that was Mr. Coffee, right?
Right.
Yeah, but he was
sitting Maxwell with a mug.
Yeah.
He had a mug in front of him.
I mean, here was a sponsor that liked him.
That's right.
He stayed with them forever. Father Knows Best, May 25th, 1950. Robert Young is Jim Anderson. His wife on this series, Jean Vanderpile, she was Wilma on the Flintstones.
Fred Flintstones.
She was Wilma, and then Bea Benaderet was Betty,
right?
And Mel Blanc was Barney, and of course Alan Reed
was Fred.
But this was a good show, and heard on NBC. Robert Young starring Father Knows Best. The announcer on this show, Bill Foreman. He sounds all really nice and really fun and all that. Well, guess what? He was the Whistler. He played the Whistler. So, yeah, I mean, you know, all he did was change his voice a little bit, Lisa, and then he was the Whistler.
Well,
and on this, and he was all like, hey.
You pretend to be nice on this show, but when, but as soon as we walk out the door, your true colors come through.
No, you should see what she's like to drive with, folks. I was driving her here. She was like, we're not
driving.
In any hurry.
We're driving.
In other words,
just slow down, dude.
You know what that means, right? We're not in any hurry. That means slow down.
This is like Speed Racer.
No, I'm just driving the speed limit.
Speed Racer.
Folks, you never, ever want
to
be the car driving with Lisa in the passenger
You seat. Are a fast
Trust
driver.
Trust me on this. You don't. All right?
Just slow down.
We'll be back after these words. One of our listeners, and our listeners are the smartest listeners in all of radio, sent in a text saying that Robert Young also promoted Sanka later in his career.
Right.
Like after maybe the Marcus Welby MD days, he was promoting Sanka. Now, I remember that. I remember Sanka.
Well, Sanka was a decaf coffee.
It was decaf only?
They started as only decaf. I think it was the first decaffeinated coffee.
See, I think Sanka is not only decaf, but regular too.
No, I know, but I think
it crystals.
Crystals. I think it started as only a decaf coffee.
Oh, really?
I think it was the first decaffeinated coffee, like, mass marketed.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're in advertising, so.
Yeah, well,
you would
now
know.
I'm in radio.
You switched careers.
I've switched many times
well,
in between.
Probably making a lot more money doing radio than you did advertising.
Oh, yeah. That's for sure. Yeah, exactly.
It's not all about money, Lisa.
I've learned
Lisa's, you know what? Money's overrated.
Is it?
Yeah.
Interesting, because we were just talking about
And you know, when you
that.
go to the Jewel, they don't want money from you. You
no.
go to Woodman's, they don't want money.
I was there today. They wanted my money.
Really? They wanted? God, not
they
me.
Did.
They just let me
Spend
just...
Spend $200 at Jewel today.
I fill up my card at Woodman's, and they just say, go right ahead.
You go ahead. Maybe you just smile real pretty.
You don't need it. Well, I just had my teeth cleaned.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
They look a little less yellow around the edges.
But Sanka, I could never drink Sanka. I tried it. You know, I could never, let me just say this. It's not Sanka. Any kind of instant coffee. I cannot drink instant coffee.
Well, here's something you
I'm
may
sort
or
of a
may
coffee
not know
snob.
About me.
I'm a little bit of a coffee snob.
Just a coffee snob. Here's something you may or may not know about me.
What's that?
I
know everything about
Well, here's thing. Something new. Here's a new
okay.
tidbit.
All right.
I have never drank coffee.
Come on. Ever.
Never.
You never had a sip of coffee.
I may have had a sip just to
well,
taste
then
it.
Well, then you had
But I've never
some.
Had a cup of coffee in my life.
But you drink tea, but not
yeah.
very...
Not
like,
too often.
This is what Lisa does with tea. This is the truth. This is a true story. This is not an exaggeration. She warms up the water, you know, very hot. Makes the water hot. Then she takes the tea bag, and she takes it. She holds it above the water, does one dip, and then throws it out.
That's true.
One dip.
I only use decaffeinated tea, first of all.
One dip in the water. That's it.
Well, there's multiple reasons.
So the water
for that.
Is still like
still
watercolor.
Kind of
it's
off
not
white.
Really.
That's true.
That's all she does.
Yeah, that's true. It's dangerous.
She's got some little quirks. Lisa has some quirks.
Yeah.
Definitely
we
does.
We all do.
And you
but
don't
you know
want to be, you don't want to drive with her.
If that's as bad as it gets, only dipping once in the tea bag, I mean, that's not so
bad.
But
what does that do? It's just like drinking hot water. There's there's no tea in there.
Almost. It's very light.
And I really like tea. I like tea. I like Earl Grey tea.
No.
No?
It's too dark. You like a nice light tea. Like
really?
A green tea. Yeah.
Lisa Wolf.
Yep. So
there's nobody quite like you.
That's for sure.
You are one in a zillion.
One in a zillion, and that's why
I'm here.
There's
6 billion people on Earth. You're one in six
one
billion.
One in 6 billion.
But then you add other planets.
Well, you know what? That's why I get to work with you, because you are one in a 6 zillion, too.
Oh, thank you very much. I guess, hopefully that's a compliment.
I think so.
All right. We listened to Father Knows Best. We had some great shows. We have another great show in
sure
our
do.
Next hour. We have Gunsmoke. And when you talk about Western series on radio, that has to be, when you're talking about adult Westerns now, I mean, you know, when you talk about Westerns, you think of The Lone Ranger, you think of Hopalong Cassidy and things like that. But when you think of adult Westerns.
Honestly, Gunsmoke is the first one that would come to my mind.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
And then maybe have Gun Will Travel after that.
And it was on television for so many years.
Yeah, that airs on
On Antenna TV.
It does. It airs all the time. You know, it airs all the time on Antenna TV. And what's great about it is on TV, it was, I think, even better. Most of the time I say the radio shows are better. But I think Gunsmoke on TV was so good. I mean, James Arness was so great as Marshall Dillon, and, you know, everybody else on there. And so, yeah, I flip through and watch Antenna TV. It's on there all the time.
Yeah.
Gunsmoke plays a lot.
And like we were saying, they had a Father Knows Best, a marathon recently. They have a lot of great stuff that really does coincide with a lot of the radio shows that we play here on
absolutely.
WGN.
Yep. In the next hour, Gunsmoke, the man who would be Marshall from 1956. Plus, we will have our segment, Just the Facts, brought to you by Cat's Pride. That's in our next hour right here. And don't forget, we're here every single Saturday at 10 p.m., unless we are being preempted for some reason. Next week, I think, just a half an hour.
I think we're starting at 10:30, but we'll still play 5 radio shows.
All right, we'll stick around because we'll be back right after the news. Hour 5 of the WGN Radio Theater. We're here every Saturday night from 10 p.m., until 3 a.m. in the morning, 5 full hours of classic radio. We play 5 of your favorite classic radio shows every single Saturday here on the greatest radio station in the world, WGN. Right, Lisa?
Yes, world's greatest newspaper. We are here.
How do you put up with me for 5 hours on a Saturday night?
I ask myself that every Saturday.
Do you every single
every
Saturday?
Every single
like
Saturday.
Clockwork?
I think to myself, am I going to be able to get through it? And somehow I always
sitting
do.
Sitting next to me.
I'm not too close.
Yeah, this is a big studio. We're not that close
to each
other.
You know, not bosom buddies here.
Right. Remember that show, Bosom Buddies?
I sure do.
That was an interesting show for the time, Bosom Buddies.
It was.
You know?
That's true.
You know, for those of you who remember it.
I do remember it.
In this hour, we're going to tune into Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. A lot of people remember Gunsmoke as a television show, of course, but had a very long run on radio with a completely different cast on radio. William Conrad was U.S. Marshal Matt Dillon. On television, of course, James Arness was Dillon. And that's coming your way in just a few minutes. You know what, though, Lisa? We haven't talked about this in a while. Remind Magazine. I'm very proud of this magazine. I've been working with Remind Magazine a long time. I write an article every issue, and this comes out once a month. It's a four-color magazine. It's actually put out by the same people that put out TV Guide, so you know you're getting quality. And Remind Magazine is all about nostalgia. It's all about radio and TV and movies. And I write an article every month called Radio 360, and we talk about a different radio show. Like, for instance, this month, this is a February issue. In the month of February, I talk about Gangbusters.
I haven't seen that issue yet.
Yeah, you haven't seen this.
No, the new one, brand new.
Yeah, because, you know, the whole issue is about the mob. You see that? You have like Scarface on the cover. You have The Sopranos on the cover. Bonnie and Clyde, you see right there. And so they always let me know ahead of time. And they say, okay, this issue is going to be about this or it's about that. And then I say, well, if it's about the mob, well, gangbusters fought the mob. So then I wrote all about gangbusters. But anyway, this magazine is really cool, folks. Check it out. Go to remindmagazine.com, and you save about 70% off the newsstand price when you order it on their website. But you can get this at any Barnes & Noble store or any Walmart store. It's on their newsstand at Barnes & Noble and Walmart. But the best way is to go to their website, remindmagazine.com. Full color catalog. This has, or not catalog, magazine, 63 pages. And look at that. Every single page is full color.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to read.
Yep, Remind Magazine.
Even for you.
That's true. All right, well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to play our game, Just the Facts, and then we're going to listen to Gunsmoke. Stick around. For News at 10, watch WGN. Micah Mater, Joe Donlin, Dan Rohn, and Chicago's most trusted meteorologist, Tom Skilling. For TV News at 10, watch Chicago's very own WGN.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you're about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
This is our new segment, Just the Facts. We're going to be talking about 1956, since our episode this hour is Gunsmoke from the year 1956, a compilation of fun facts, trivia, and history.
All right.
All right. The first fact is, on 1956, Elvis Presley appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show on September 9th.
Right.
82.6% of American households watch that episode.
But they did not film him from the waist down.
That is true.
Yeah, they filmed him from the waist up.
See, you even knew that.
They would not. Yeah, they would not. You know, they were, the censor said,
Yep.
He wiggles way too much.
This is Elvis Presley. He's a sexy guy.
Not as sexy as I am.
Well, no, of course not. That's a given.
I mean, but who is?
Film you, we're going to only go from waist up.
Right, just go from my neck up.
Okay.
Because you wouldn't be able to handle it.
Maybe we'll just go from the eyes up.
You would turn the TV off.
Let's leave out the chin. We'll go from the top.
You mean all my chins?
That's what I'm saying. Right. Okay.
Multiple chins.
All right. Also, on July 9th of 1956, Dick Clark began hosting American Bandstand.
Wow, it started in 1956?
It sure did. All of this is 1956. Did you used to watch American Bandstand?
Oh, of course.
I did too.
You know, that's why I can dance so great today.
Oh, it must be because of American Bandstand.
Remember that show, though? Remember the black and white version? They were all dancing.
You know, I used to think those were really special people that got to dance up on the platforms.
Yeah.
And they had a lot more camera time than the regular groups. And I thought, well, that could be me.
American Bandstand.
Right?
Wow.
1956.
Dick Clark.
Also, now this is a really great fact. On NBC introduced its multicolored peacock logo.
Wow, that's when it came out, huh?
Yep, to entice people to buy color TVs manufactured by RCA, which owned the network.
Right, and they would make that sound. You know, it was like the peacock and then the sound.
It would
I remember that.
That was all 1956.
Wow.
So gives you a little bit of history into 1956 and what was going on.
Very, very cool, Lisa. Just the facts. Lisa has all the facts for you.
Oh, yes. Not all of them, but a few important ones.
Of the hour. Every hour here on the WGN Radio Theater. But right now, it is time for Gunsmoke. Now, Gunsmoke was an adult Western series. It was created by Norman McDonald and John Meston. Came to radio in 1952, lasted all the way until 1961. And now, these were stories in and around Dodge City, Kansas, in the mid to late 1800s. And Marshal Matt Dillon was played by William Conrad. Parley Bear was Deputy Chester Proudfoot. Howard McNair was Doc Adams, Georgia Ellis was Kitty Russell, and Dillon was a lonely, very isolated man. He was toughened by a hard life, and it was very popular. I mean, because it was really an adult Western. This was not like The Lone Ranger for kids or Hopalong Cassidy. This was for adults, a good Western. And you know what? It was so popular on radio that they did a transition to television, and it became even more popular on TV. And it really paved the way for all kinds of other Westerns like The Rifleman and Wagon Train and, you know, all the adult Westerns, Bonanza.
Yeah.
You know, these were all super, super popular on television. And all of those that we just mentioned air on our very own Antenna TV. Don't miss it, because they air on Antenna TV just about every single day and night. Right?
Right. Yeah, we love Antenna TV.
That's right. All right, we have a Gunsmoke episode for you now from March 18th, 1956. This is called The Man Who Would Be Marshall. Here's William Conrad in Gunsmoke.
Gunsmoke. Around Dodge City and in the territory on West, there's just one way to handle the killers and the spoilers, and that's with a U.S. Marshal and the smell of gun smoke. Gunsmoke, starring William Conrad. The transcribed story of the violence that moved west with young America. And the story of a man who moved with it.
I'm that man, Matt Dillon, United States Marshal. The first man they look for and the last they want to meet. It's a chancy job, and it makes a man watchful and a little lonely.
This the marshal's office?
Yeah, come in, stranger.
You're Marshal Dillon?
I am.
My name's Egan, Marshal. Emmett Egan.
I'm glad to know you. It's Chester Proudfoot.
How do you do?
Hello.
The purpose of my visit may surprise you, Marshal.
Well, if it doesn't mean trouble, it sure will.
I've just deposited $50,000 in the bank here.
Huh?
That's a lot of money, Egan.
Well, it's taken me ever since the war to earn it. I've been up in Chicago, Marshal, running cattle auctions for a man named Swift, but I'm through with that now.
Yeah?
I'm going to try something new. Marshal, I don't intend any insult, but if you need money, name your price.
I'm afraid I don't follow you, Egan.
I want your job.
What?
I want to be Marshal here.
All right, say it out, Egan.
I'm serious, Marshal. No tricks to this. I've been to Washington, and the War Department's endorsed my application, but they tell me there are no openings, so I came to Dodge. I thought if I can somehow persuade you to quit, maybe they'll put me on here.
I think you are serious.
Oh, I am. It's simple enough. I'm tired of the kind of work I was doing, and I want to try this. Something exciting.
Oh, I see.
What would you advise me to do, Marshal?
Go back to Chicago. You're a lot safer there.
You think I'm not qualified to be a lawman?
Well, you're wearing a gun.
Well, I'm accustomed to authority, Marshal. I was a major under General McClellan. Took my first bullet in the Chickahominy in 62.
I see. Is this your first trip to the frontier, Mr. Egan?
It was my first since 67.
Uh-huh. Well, I still advise you to go back to Chicago.
No, Marshal.
All right, Mr. Egan, you want this job so bad, you can have it, as far as I'm concerned.
Now, Mr. Dillon...
There's very little money in it, and absolutely no thanks. I've been a live target for every drunken bum and glory hunter in Kansas about long enough.
You mean it, Marshal?
Yeah. But on one condition.
Yeah?
That you hang around for a week, see what it's like. And then, if you still want it...
Oh, I'll want it, all right.
All right, then we'll start right now.
I'm ready. What do we do first?
You all set, Chester?
My. Yes, sir, I guess so.
All right, then follow me.
Why don't you sit down and rest a spell, Mr. Egan?
No, thanks.
He's gonna wear himself out walking up and down that way.
Yeah. You got a match, Chester.
Mm-hmm. Here, Red. Here.
Oh, thanks.
Your dog sure ain't very lively today, is it?
Not very.
If I only had me a knife, I could do a little whittling.
Oh, what happened to your knife, Chester?
Well, it was about wore out, so I traded it to a small kid I know for a flipper.
Why don't you get yourself another one?
Mr. Dillon, I am so mean poor, I just couldn't stand the outlay of another knife.
Oh, yeah, I forgot.
Hey, look there. Somebody hadn't ought to be in town.
Oh, where? Who?
That fella coming up the street, riding that sway back to old Broodmare, see him?
He looks like a farmer.
If you call a man whose wife hoes a 10-yard patch of mealy potatoes a farmer, then he's one, all right.
You said he shouldn't be in town. He can't be very dangerous.
He's dangerous to himself.
Oh, what do you mean?
Why, he gets a doggone drunk every time he comes in here. He can't hardly climb back up on that old mare. And when he does, he usually falls off somewhere before he gets home and lays out there on the prairie all night like a dead man. It's a pure wonder he ain't been et by something.
Oh, Marshal, we've been hanging around this porch for 3 hours. I'm beginning to feel like a bum myself.
Now, that's part of the job, Egan. Keeping an eye on things, we call it.
Keeping an eye on things? You and Chester both are fighting to stay awake.
Are you calling it quits, Egan?
Oh, no. Of course not.
Then let's go get a cup of coffee, huh? It'll be dark soon, and we can start making the rounds.
What's the name of this place, Marshal?
It's called the Long Branch. Oh, here comes somebody you ought to know.
Evening, Mac.
Oh, Kitty.
How long you been sitting here?
Not long. Kitty, this is Emmett Egan.
How do you do, Miss Kitty?
Mr. Egan?
Oh, you sit down.
I hear you may be our new Marshal.
What? Well, now, how in the world...
Well, Chester was in a while ago. It's true, isn't it?
Well, it isn't exactly settled yet, Miss Kitty.
But you want the job?
Yes.
Why?
Well, let's say I was bored with what I was doing.
Sure. That's happened to a lot of ex-soldiers. They can't stand peacetime.
Me in particular, I guess.
Why don't you re-enlist? The cavalry keeps busy out here.
I tried that, Miss Kitty.
You did?
Back in 67.
67?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. The Cheyenne and the Sioux were real active that year, weren't they?
Yes, they were, but not where the cavalry was.
Wait a minute. Were you with General Hancock?
That's right, Marshal. We took to the field for 4 months. We marched and counter-marched all over this country, and then we returned to Fort Harker.
Well, what was wrong with that?
Well, all we did was burn one empty village, kill two young Cheyenne braves, both of whom we later found out were friendly. It took 1,100 men to do that.
Oh.
Mr. Dillon.
Yeah, what is it, Chester?
I don't know for sure, but I hear there's some kind of trouble down at Moss Grimmick Stadium.
Well, no. It's about time something happened around here.
Yeah. Now, don't forget, Egan, when it does, somebody usually dies.
Something
What's the trouble here, men?
Inside.
Where's Moss Grimmick, Chester?
Well, he ain't here, Mr. Dillon. They say Leonard Phibbs there is the one who knows about it.
Oh, Phibbs, a little sodbuster?
Yes, sir. Hey, Phibbs, come here.
What's going on here, Phibbs?
Inside, Marshal. Back there in the stall.
Oh, what's back there?
Bad, Marshal, real bad. Don't nobody go in there. It's real bad.
What is? Who's in there, Phibbs?
Not even you, Marshal. Not nobody. Leave him alone, I'm warning you.
Oh, he ain't got good sense, Mr. Dillon. No use talking to him.
It's real bad in there.
Yeah, something's got him scared half to death. I'm going to go take a look. You stay here, Chester.
I'm going with you, Marshal.
Look, Egan, I don't know what's in there. It could be a crazy man with a gun looking for blood. It could be anything.
Action is what I came here for, Marshal, and you said I could hang around.
All right, but you get out of the way if there's any shooting.
I'm not entirely a novice with a gun, Marshal.
No, but you're not a professional either. Now stay at least 10 paces behind me.
Right. See anything?
No. It's Marshal Dillon. Who's in here? Come on, speak up.
Maybe he's hiding, waiting for you.
Well, he can't see me any better than I can see him.
You're taking an awful chance, Marshal.
You stay where you are, Egan. What? What's this? Chester, bring a lantern. All right, Egan.
What is it, Marshal?
Nothing we have to kill.
What do you mean?
You'll see when Chester brings the light.
Oh, he's coming.
What have we found, Mr. Dillon?
Hold the lantern over here, Chester.
Yes, sir. Oh, my goodness. Somebody's gone and hung a man.
So that's it. That poor devil. Was this a lynching, Marshal?
No, Egan, that's old Tom Sanders. He's been drunk for 20 years. Yeah, I guess he finally decided to break the habit. Yeah, you won't get any action out of this. Egan, it's been nearly a week. Enough excitement for you?
I must admit, Marshal, it's not quite what I'd expected. Somehow I had the idea Marshal was always busy, doing things.
You mean gunfighting?
I've told you I don't think gunfighting's necessary.
Yeah, I remember.
Any man accustomed to command should be able to control these Dodge City ruffians without much trouble.
I only draw my gun as a last resort, Egan. And besides, you haven't seen any of these men in action yet.
I still want the job, Marshal.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, Matt?
Yeah, come on in, Doc.
Say, Matt, you'd better get over the Texas Trail.
Oh?
You know those fellas, Gear and Bozeman?
Yeah, I know them.
Well, they've got that poor little Leonard Phibbs at the bar there, and they're trying to make him pay for their drinks. He's broke, of course, so they're beating him up. They're doing it real slowly, bit by bit. I tell you, it just makes you sick to watch it.
All right, Doc.
Wait, Marshal.
Yeah, what?
Let me handle this.
Look, Egan, Gear and Bozeman may be a couple of bullies, but that doesn't mean they're not dangerous. They are.
Are you afraid I might be able to handle them, Marshal? Well?
Okay, go ahead. Here, take my badge. Tell them you're a deputy.
Thank you, Marshal.
You gotta learn one way or the other.
Thank you.
Come on, Chester.
I knew you wouldn't leave Mr. Egan all alone.
Nobody will look for us coming in the back door. And let's move a little closer.
Egan's facing him, Mr. Dillon.
Yeah.
Oh, look at poor little Pilgrim. They got him all bloody.
What makes you think you can do this to a man? Is there no law where you come from?
We come from Dodge, Mr. Deputy. Where do you come from?
Are you Bozeman or Gear?
I'm Bozeman, Mr. Deputy. I'm the one who generally does the talking, but we both do the fighting.
You're out of order, Bozeman.
What's that?
I said you're out of order. I will not tolerate your insolence.
I'm not sure, Mr. Deputy. But are you saying you don't like us?
That's enough. You and Gear will turn and face the bar while I take your guns.
You're the most doggone foolish man I ever saw, Mr. Deputy.
Do as I say.
Why? Because you're wearing a badge?
That's reason enough.
Now, Mr. Deputy, that may be reason enough
for
you.
There'll be no shooting. I'm ordering you to face the bar.
I guess there's no use talking to you, Mr. Deputy. I'll take him along here.
He's going.
Hold it, Bozeman! All right, that's enough. Well, go ahead, Bozeman. Try it again.
Now, wait, Marshal.
You knew he couldn't handle a gun. You know I can. Is that it?
Your gun against two of us?
Quit talking, Bozeman.
Don't try it, Gear.
All right, then do as my deputy told you. Face the bar.
Sure. Sure, Marshal.
Chester.
Yes, sir. You want me to lock him up, Mr. Dillon?
Here are the guns, Chester. I'll be at Doc's. Maybe he can save Bozeman here from hanging. Yeah, it's getting light out, Doc.
It generally does this time of morning.
Yeah, but I'm not generally sitting up waiting for a man to die.
He isn't going to die, Matt.
Well, I saw what that bullet did to him.
You feel guilty, don't you, Matt?
Wouldn't you, Doc?
Yes, I guess I would.
Doc?
Oh.
What?
Well, he's conscious. Well, how do you feel, Egan?
Pretty fair, Doc. I've been lying here, listening to you talk.
Well, you mean you've been conscious for some time?
Half hour, maybe. I wanted to get my head clear.
Well, a few weeks in bed and it'll be clear enough.
I guess I was lucky.
If that bullet had gone 1 inch to the left, you'd have died on the floor, Egan. You were lucky, all right.
God protects fools and drunkards, isn't it? Marshal Dillon.
Yeah.
I heard you saying you felt guilty about this. It wasn't your fault.
And I should have known what had happened.
But I heard you telling Doc how it happened. You faced them the same way I did, and they didn't shoot you.
It's a little different with me, Egan.
How?
This is my profession.
I've handled enough men to be professional.
Egan, why do you think Bozeman did what I told him to do?
Because he knew you'd shoot if he didn't?
He not only knew I'd shoot, he knew I'd kill him. He knows I can handle a gun pretty well. And that part of the profession they don't teach in the Army. Takes years and years to learn.
Well, I can't complain any more about there not being enough action, can I, Marshal?
Hey, your week's up today, Egan. You want the job?
Marshal, you ever been in California?
Not for some time.
I hear things are pretty active out there. I'll write you and tell you all about it.
You know, there were a lot of ways for death to come to a man on the frontier. All of them hard. But next week, a man meets death the hardest way of all, at the end of a rope. But that was the West. Good night.
Gunsmoke, produced and directed by Norman McDonald, stars William Conrad as Matt Dillon, U.S. Marshal. Our story was specially written for Gunsmoke by John Meston, with music composed and conducted by Rex Corey. Sound patterns by Tom Hanley and Bill James. Featured in the cast were John Daner, James Nusser, and Harry Bartell. Parley Bear is Chester, Howard McNear is Doc, and Georgia Ellis is Kitty. Join us again next week for another specially transcribed story on Gunsmoke.
And that's Gunsmoke from March 18th, 1956, with a man who would be Marshal. It's heard on CBS Radio, starring William Conrad as U.S. Marshal Matt Dillon. Also in that cast, John Daner, James Nusser, Harry Bartell, Howard McNear, and Parley Bear and Georgia Ellis, with George Walsh doing the announcing. Now, that was originally sponsored by Chesterfield and L&M Filters, but we had to remove those cigarette commercials. We don't air cigarette commercials on the radio. Hope you enjoyed Gunsmoke. And speaking of Gunsmoke, Lisa, Gunsmoke is one of the five free radio shows that you can get. Uninterrupted, complete episodes, five digitally remastered free shows because you are a listener to this radio show. It's our way of thanking you for being a listener. Just go to our website, 100radioshows.com, the number 100radioshows.com. When you log on to that website, you will see at the top, you enter your email address, and we will instantly send you five shows: Fibber McGee and Molly, Gunsmoke, Jack Benny, Suspense, and Richard Diamond, Private Detective, digitally remastered by the great Mike Costella. And they're sent to you, as I said, instantly to your email. And those links will never expire. That's our way of saying thank you. But if you want to purchase any shows at that website, and there are hundreds of shows at that website, make sure that you use the promo code radio at checkout. Promo code is radio, and you will save 70% off the regular price. And that's our, again, way of thanking you for listening to this radio show, 100radioshows.com. Let's take a quick break, and then it's more here on the WGN Radio Theater. Lisa, we're going on a cruise August 1st of this year.
I can't believe it's here. We've been talking about it and thinking about it for so long, and it's almost that time.
You know what? I could use a cruise right now with this weather.
I need a vacation.
This is nuts. This is cold. This is really cold. I'm wearing like two jackets, like two hats.
Well, hopefully it'll warm up a little bit between now and August, but either way, it'll be great to get away, have a classic radio clues, and take a vacation with Lisa and Carl.
That's right. Going to Bermuda August 1st.
Right. We're going on Oceana Cruise Line, which luxurious cruise line. We're going to have a lot of fun. We're going to bake in the sun. And at the same time, we're going to...
You're not going to be baking in the sun.
I'll just, you
she
know,
doesn't go in the
bake
sun.
Bake a little bit in the
Lisa?
Sun. We'll have a little classic radio fun, and we'll explore Bermuda, all of the above. And of course, you'll be at this casino and having some big dinners every night.
But let me tell you something. When it is sunny out, I will be by the pool. I will be getting some sun.
Well, I will be by the pool too, under an umbrella.
With your floppy hat
that
Luann
sure.
got for
That's
you.
That's right. I'm waiting.
And you know, barking orders to me. Get me a pina colada.
No,
get
no,
me this.
No.
Get
I'm gonna,
me that.
I'm going to need
She'll
my,
be barking
my
orders.
Cabana boy will do that for me. You sit.
Yeah, we're going to get to know our listeners so much better. We can't wait to meet you out there in Radio Land. Come with us on our cruise. It's August 1st, 2020.
Right. We're working with a great travel agency, Keen Luxury Travel. They've given us a great group rate. It is a limited offer because when it's full, it's full. Here is the number. Give them a call. It is 800-856-1155. That's 800-856-1155. 1155, or you can go to WGNRadiotheater.com and you can click on the cruise banner and learn some more there as well.
Yeah, but if you call that toll-free number, they'll answer all your questions for you. They'll walk you through the whole thing. And this sails out of New York, and it's 7 nights. It's going to be incredible. And we are going to have some radio reenactments. We're going to do trivia contests, a cocktail party.
And prizes, because who doesn't love WGN Radio Theater prizes?
But the real prize is getting to hang with us.
The real prize is you, Carl.
And it's going to be a lot of fun, so make sure you check it out. Come with us to Bermuda. All right, now next week, next Saturday, we start half an hour late?
Yeah, we're starting at 10:30, so we are going to start with a 15-minute Vic and Sade episode.
Right.
And then we have The Shadow,
right.
Broadway Is My Beat, Dimension X, and Nick Carter, Master Detective.
Wow, so good lineup. All right, so don't forget, folks, next Saturday we start a half an hour late. We're beginning at 10:30, and we'll go to 3 o'clock in the morning right here on the greatest radio station in the world, WGN. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks to Shante Garth, our producer, and Mike Costello, our executive producer. And, of course, thank you out there in Radio Land for listening. We'll see you next week.